Welcome, honorable members, the department, the representatives from Makua and Wamua. I hope I'm correct the way I pronounce it. You are welcome to this meeting today. Later on, the representatives from ESCOM. All welcome to the committee staff, and everyone is welcome in the meeting. I see we are almost on time. Please bear with me because I'm using my hand gadget, which is the cell phone. I still have a problem with my iPad. But having said so, let me take any apologies.
Good morning, Chair, members, and our guest. I just received one apology from Mr. Volmarans, who will be joining us at 10. That's the only apology I have, Chair.
Okay, the department. I assume there is no one.
I will leave at 11, Chair.
Okay. Well, welcome on.
I must go to the NCCC.
Okay. Welcome, Honorable Minister. I didn't see you that you were present. Okay. Makua and Wamua. Am I correct? Are you present?
Yes, Chair, they are.
I think they are trying. Can is I see there's some Mr. I assume Mr. Michel. You must find a spot. I can hear anything.
Yes, Chair, we are here.
Yeah, we are present.
Please try and find a good spot. Yes, please try and find a good spot. Your reception that side is not good. It's going to deprive you. We want to hear you so that... please, okay. Okay, let's welcome... It's our first meeting with Makua. Maybe I must give a background. We received that an instruction. This is what does from the speaker's office, that there were issues that were raised in relation to the sector, in particular mining, where we are by representatives of communities and women in mining. I assume I'm correct. I won't try and bore with the long technicalities of Parliament, except to say we welcome and we want to deal and tackle with some of the issues that are being raised. You are welcome to this portfolio committee. Your matter is with us. Finally, is with us. I don't want us to go back, as I said, on how, because sometimes procedures of Parliament can be too technical. And we accept and appreciate members of the public that at times they may not understand how these processes operate. But having said so, there were quite a number of issues that were raised. And we're of the view that we should not limit Makua, because this is our first meeting. It's important just we interact. They may share with us who are they, what are they doing, and so forth and so forth, and then give us a background. So we didn't want to limit you only on the issues that we raised there. We thought because it's our first meeting, we will take things as they go on and then deal. What will Having said so, can I then, I'm not sure, please, the Makua representatives, you can stay, maybe introduce your delegation, then you brief the committee on the matter of interest that we are with today. I'm giving it to you. At least I hope within 30 minutes you will be done with the presentation, and then we'll take it from there, and then we will allow the department to comment or respond on some of the issues, because they also relate on the interaction between yourselves and the department. So we said they're not going to necessarily make a presentation on the matter, but they will have to take comment on the issues that are raised in relation to the interaction between yourselves. So can I give it to Makua Wamua? Yes. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Comrade Chair Lozipo. You are who's speaking at the moment is Comrade Sean Letoko. I'm the provincial coordinator of Makua in Northwest. Yes, I will go through the presentation quickly. I'm also with other leaders from other provinces, Nomonde from Mpumalanga, Mokete from Limpopo, and also Comrade Meshak from Gauteng, and also Robert Cruz and Louis Neyman from CALS. Thank you. So yes, I will go. We have shared our presentation on the slide. Yes. Makua is a national movement of mining affected communities who are marginalized and who have been excluded in mining procedures and mining decisions in South Africa. Mining affected communities united in action, which is Makua, and women affected by mining united in action, WAMUA, are fraternal organizations formed in response to the need to protect the integrity and the interest of the people impacted by mining. Makua and WAMUA form a movement aimed at raising the voice of communities who have not been consulted in the process of allocating mining licenses, developing communities and in the distribution of rent and wealth, but who bear the brunt of the social, economic and environmental degradation and impact of mining. We currently have 40 Makua branches around the country, 13 WAMUA branches, 9 youth branches, 6,000 signed up members, and collected over 50,000 signatures in support of free prior informed consent. We are here to ask this portfolio committee to honor its constitutional duty, which is Section 59 of the Constitution. The National Assembly must facilitate public involvement in the legislative and other processes of the Assembly and its committees. We have been deliberately excluded through legislation because what we say and what our communities are asking for does not fit into the plan of some to use the mining sector to enrich themselves. For years, we have been knocking on the doors of Parliament and this committee without success. We have been forced to go to court on two previous occasions to claim our rights to be consulted. In May of this year, we are going back to the court to challenge our exclusion from the mining charter. As the stakeholders in the sector that bears the negative impacts of mining, we are the only one not at the table. We are also the ones who gain the least from the sector. Our research shows that mining companies allocate 0.9% of mining revenues to SLP, which is social and labor plans, and 70% of that does not reach communities affected by mining. Our research also shows that our communities are impoverished, while mining companies export billions of rand, 73% of our communities indicate that no individuals in their household were either currently employed or previously employed by the mine. Of the 27% of who indicated that someone in their household was employed at the mine, 41% indicated that they were casual or manual jobs. 91% of the respondents did not know what social labor plan was. 85% did not know of any structures in their community who engaged with the mine on SLPs. 95% have never seen a document called social labor plan. 79% indicate that there was no benefit from the mines at all, while 8% felt that the mine only brought negative benefits such as sickness, dispossession, and damages. 13% felt that were positive benefits such as clinics. Why are we here? We are here because 40% of women indicated that jobs are only accessible through sexual favors. 14% of women indicated that some sort of payment fee or bribe was needed in order to secure a job in mining. 73% of women indicated that they have received no benefit from the mine. 25% of the women indicated that community experienced substantial amounts of violence such as rape, murder, abuse, and protest. While 85% of women linked the increase in violence to the development of the mine. Recently, Mama Fikile Ntsangase was brutally assassinated because she opposed the Tendele coal mine that is destroying her community. From 2007 to 2018, the South African mining industry has accumulated and reported net profit of 221 billion over this period. Close to 5.92 billion of the estimated 7.5 billion earmarked for the community development did not reach its intended beneficiaries during this period. Projects meant to advance community development are not trickling down to the communities. The promise of progress and development driven by SLPs and the mining charter are not evident. And the evidence points instead to a far more systematic process of excluding the solution, which the baseline survey points to, produces a structure within which the social and economic outcomes are experienced as a violation against person of those affected. In 2015, after consulting 21 civil society organizations and over 150 communities, we adopted People's Mining Charter. The Mining Charter outlines 10 principles that we hope to achieve in South Africa one day. These are, number one, community voice in decision making through negotiation based on right of consent to determine what activities occur on one's land. Number two, democratic community representation and customary decision-making process that are community-based and not based on undemocratic traditional authority. Number three, benefits from mining activities, profits, employment, procurement, and all local economic development should be shared equitably distributed to directly affected communities near mining communities, workers, and the public through a democratic process. Communities bear a disproportionate burden of the cost of mining.
It's normal, and I guess part of it is about you
independent, accessible, and effective recourse mechanism before, during, and after mining. Number six, rehabilitation standards should ensure that the land is no worse than when mining started. Number seven, restitution and reparation should correct historical wrongs and should include environmental, social, cultural, and heritage rights, including spiritual connection to land, people, and nature. Number eight, compensation for loss of livelihoods and economic, social, environmental, and cultural and heritage resource should be based on full cost accounting, including future losses of alternative development paths and value loss of minerals. Number nine, women must have the right to inherit land and should be consulted on all issues affecting their bodies, families, land, and lives in both customary traditional structures and community, local, provincial, and national structures. Number 10, decriminalize and legalize, regulate artisanal mining sector. Thank you. I will pause there for now. Okay. They're still continuing. I'm sorry. For the portfolio committee to start an immediate investigation into why legislation continues to exclude nations of activists, to instruct the DMRE to immediately start negotiations with affected communities on how to introduce a greater inclusivity into the current legislation, to instruct the DMRE to abide by previous court rulings that recognizes us as interested and affected stakeholders that must be consulted, and to start consulting us on communities where violence continue to destabilize the community, such as in community of Mononono and in the community of Palaburwa and community of Margaret and so on. Instruct the DMRE to stop the practice of negotiating with traditional leaders to the exclusion of the community. I also want the portfolio committee to instruct the DMRE to immediately start working with Mining Affected Communities United in Action, which is MACUWA, in its social audit of social and labor plans in all affected communities to ensure that community voices are included and heard. The lived experience of communities affected by mining do not coincide with the claims by government and corporations that mining has been a positive force for development in South Africa. The nature of the unequal way that benefits have accrued to stakeholders of the sector have arguably outweighed the generic contribution that mining has made in the development of the economy as a whole. From its earliest manifestation as a large-scale exploitative project, contestation about ownership and wealth distribution has characterized the sector, with wars, deprivation, and exploitation featuring throughout its more than 150 years of history. Empirically, there is this connection between poverty and inequality in South Africa. While South Africa has made notable progress in terms of aggregate poverty reduction, this has not been accompanied by corresponding reduction in inequality. Growth does not necessarily affect poverty and inequality, either together or indeed at all. It is highly likely that inequality drives much of the social unrest in South Africa and has both a direct and indirect impact on dampening growth rates in the country. Left to their own devices, local and provincial governments working in collaboration with mining corporations are not able to deliver developmental outcomes without acknowledging the developmental imperative of nurturing and fostering community-initiated and controlled accountability mechanisms. This means unlearning the paternalistic notions of top-down development and encouraging, as the National Development Plan does. The local government should engage and be held accountable by communities, not in the invited spaces controlled by officials, but in the created spaces of community collectives. Not only will a deeper institutionalization of community participation assist with ensuring that developmental projects are relevant to the community, but community oversight can also assist in reducing corruption and ensuring that benefits accrue to those who is meant to accrue to. This is the reason why Makua is always emphasizing that nothing about mining communities without mining communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Makua, for your presentation. At least now, we've got a sense of what is in it. Without any further delays, can I give the department, it's supposed to be just 10 minutes response on the issues that were raised. Because the delegation now led by the minister, can I give it to you, Honorable Minister?
Yeah, thank you very much, Comrade Zad. That DDGs here who run branches that interact regularly with Makua in the department. I'll give them first and then round it up at the end. Togozo and Makubela, may you react and I will speak last.
Morning, Minister. Morning, Honorable Chair and members of the committee, and Makua members as well as Wamua. Firstly, Minister, I would want to comment on the issue that was raised about communities not having seen what an SOP looks like. We acknowledge that. And we've done something about it already. If you go through the 2018 mining charter, which we gazetted on the 27th of September, we did make it a requirement for mining companies to publish their approved social endeavor plans. So it's now required of them to do that. The second point I would want to comment on is the point about the department developing a framework, a separate a legislative framework for artisanal miners. Both Makua and Wamua have been consulted by us last year when we were drafting the policy for artisanal mining. So I know that they are aware of that, that we've drafted the policy and we did consult them when we were drafting the policy. Where we are now with that policy is that we are going to be going out to consult communities, but we want to run it as a parallel process where we are going to gazette to solicit input for all interested and affected parties while we go out and consult mining affected communities. So that work is underway. On other issues, I think maybe I should pause here, Minister, and leave the other issues, which are more licensing issues, to DDG Makubela. Thanks, Minister. Thanks, Chair.
Kubel, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Honorable Minister, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. From my side, I think the first thing I want to state is the fact that, of course, we implement the law as we find it. And at the moment, the MPRDA places the state as the custodian of mineral and petroleum resources of the country. And in doing so, we make sure that there is sufficient consultation. At least there are processes for consultation, both in law, but also in the regulation. But as to the efficacy of some of the consultations, I think perhaps it is an area that we can look at. But I think there are provisions in law for public consultation. The decision-making, however, in law rests with the minister. And that's how the law is at the moment. With all those provisions for consultation. Also, in terms of the MPRDA, there is a requirement for the regional manager to make known an application. So that's the process that is followed. And in doing so, the interested and affected parties have 30 days to submit their comments. Now, there is also a structure in the region called the Regional Mining Development and Environmental Committee. That committee is the one that oversees any objections that arise from community members or any other persons that are affected. But also, the MPRDA requires that a holder must then give notice to a landowner before any mining activity commences. So I'm raising these issues because I think there is in terms of both the MPRDA but also in terms of NEMA, there are sufficient, NEMA being the National Environmental Management Act, there are sufficient provisions for consultation. I think what we can engage on, of course, is the efficacy of that, and we are open to that. Lastly, we have been approached by Makua and Wamua to conduct training on SLPs. And we have scheduled, in fact, there is a scheduled training that we will give to Wamua and Makua on SLPs. And that training is scheduled for the 19th of March. So we are open for engagement we will do what it takes to make sure that the efficacy of that consultation with the public is improved. But in conclusion, that to say that we implement the law as we find it. We don't make up rules as we proceed. Thank you, Honorable Minister.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. We have been engaging with Makua and Wamua, as you hear, Chairperson. We are ready to talk to them all the time. When I came to the Department of Mineral Resources, one of the things I did was to visit communities in 9 major regions that are mining regions. In all those meetings, Makua at least was there in all of them. Wamua was there in some. We had a mining charter summit. At least Makua was there. The provision for community shares in all new licenses is a function of development. That means history is evolving. what community formations can help us with is to help us think through what is the right structure to put those shares on. For example, for workers, it goes to ESOPs. For communities, you get a trust. Few intelligent people hijack that trust and squander the money belonging to communities. And all those things. Then community structures must be able to help us think through what is the best structure that can help us manage that situation. So that's where we are, Chairperson. We're ready to talk to anybody, including myself, by the way. I only met Makua and Mabua in newspapers saying all sorts of things about me in person. That doesn't bother me. That is an occupational hazard. That people are going to insult you and call your names. That's an occupational hazard. I take it as I move. But the reality of the matter is that we're talking to everybody. But what we're not going to do is to give up the right to issue license to anybody. We won't do that. Processes will follow. Thank you.
There are some issues that I think Makua has raised, and I think we will have to see how do we take some of these issues forward from a committee point of view, but generally, whether they fit within the committee or they require parliament, because they might transcend the responsibilities of this committee. But at this stage, I'm trying to check very quickly whether are there any honorable members who wants to have a take. I see Honorable Mailem. Any other hand? I see Honorable Madogwe. I see Honorable Malinga. I see Honorable Kula. In that fashion, can I give Honorable Mailem, then Honorable Madogwe, then Honorable Malinga, then Honorable Kula?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, first of all, let me acknowledge the presentation and thank Makua and Wamua for the presentation. I do think there's a lot of things that we can learn here that we can use to improve the process going forward. But I do have some questions. So my first question is, in the presentation, it said that this relates to Section 59 of the Constitution, which speaks specifically to public participation in the legislative process of Parliament. And I'd like some clarity here from Makua as to whether they are alleging that during the development of the MPRDA and later the mining charter, there was no public participation at all, or whether they did not participate in it. It's a very different thing to say, well, Parliament failed in its duty to conduct public participation, to saying, well, there was public participation, but we weren't part of it. So I'd like some clarity on that. The second thing is, and this relates to the social and labor plans of mining companies. Makua, could you advise us whether you have any input whatsoever into those plans, whether there's any consultation taking place at a grassroots level between the mining companies and local communities? And if so, what is the nature of that consultation? I know that they are interacting with local municipalities, but is there consultation taking place with the communities? And then I'd just like a clarity. In your People's Mining Charter, one of your demands, or I don't know how to put it, is compensation for loss of livelihoods. Now, I'm trying to understand what livelihoods are being lost by the development of mines. Can you clarify that for me, please? Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay. Honorable Matoga.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd also like to welcome the and also the responses from the question more than it is an observation, in the sense that there looks like there is a serious disjuncture between the policies and the processes that DMRE has in place versus what is actually happening on the ground. And why I'm saying this, for instance, is that one of the speakers spoke about him having adjusted some of the policies as in like in September last year, but the presentation of Makua mentions like a familiar community, which is Mononong. And I recall the story of Mononong where people were actually shot at, people in their 60s, in their 70s, very old people at the beginning of this year. And they were shot at mainly because there was a court process that was in place and the mining company had been asked to stop mining, but they had been continuing to mine. And despite them following different options, including the DMRE, there was no intervention, none whatsoever, to the point that the community had to now confront the securities, which ended up very badly. So this shows that it means that there needs to be much more extensive conversations. And these conversations, I think that this meeting and the portfolio committee are not sufficient. I do hear as well that the department is saying that they are willing to engage, but I think as well in that, let us put time frames, perhaps say, look, let us meet on a particular date. Otherwise, we'll say, let us engage until Jesus comes. And also another thing, just not just on Makua as well, but the separation, I would say, of who gets to speak on mining activities as well, is also evident in the fact that there's bodies such as the Alternative Mining Indaba. And that also stems from the fact that people who feel like they have a voice or should have a voice in issues that have to do with mining cannot even access the currently set up mining Indaba. So it's just a request for me, an observation and a request that perhaps a much more extensive conversation has to be had, particularly with the DMRE, communities, mining unions, and also the mining companies, because they are also very important. It doesn't make sense for us to have conversations and not part of the conversation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay, Honorable Malinga.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Greetings to yourself, my colleagues in the Portfolio Committee, the Minister and the delegation from the department, also the Makua and Wamua delegations. Chairperson, let me welcome the presentation that has been just outlined to us. I have a few questions, Chair. I'm a bit confused that what is it that is needed from us as the portfolio committee? Because I heard the presenter, he kept on saying they demand that the portfolio committee hold the department accountable. I don't know if that is our jurisdiction, because see, now we do oversight on what the department has put out there to be doing. Chairperson, also the issue that Honorable Matokwe has just cited, I just wanted to check with the department whether they have followed the incident. Did they get the incident report on what had happened there? Chair, on the Makua presentation, there are slides on why are we here. You see, as a parliamentarian, I find it very difficult when issues of sexual favors are being outlined, and we have no cases furnished to us that this and so wanted a job, and for her to get that job, she was coerced to having sex, and there was a case that was opened. The case maybe did not fall through. I thought those were the issues that we're going to get. Also, Chairperson, on the issue of the SLP, I think with the mining, maybe that's the space where DMRE has to come closer, because SLP issue is a very touchy one, because we also had the same challenge of visiting Northam, because the communities there felt that they were not taken into account in terms of the SLP. And I would really like to appeal to the department that they really sit down with this mining in terms of the SLP. I hear what the minister is saying, that maybe the communities or the leaders of the communities should tell them how this should be done, maybe in a form of trust, then for employees in a form of skills or whatever. But I really share this is disturbing me, that this slide of sexual favors that is not substantiated. Can we have cases where there are people who say, Tina, we want a job and we were requested to lie down on our backs to get those jobs, Chairperson. Let me stop there for now, Chair. Thank you very much.
Rabukul?
No, Ndia Bulela Stalo. Let me welcome the presentation by Makua and its fraternal organization. My first question, which I wanted to speak on the question that I think it is if my understanding serves me correct, I think the Makua does not suggest that they've not been consulted on policy development in the mining sector when they speak on Section 59. I want to know that whether am I correct to say that they were just quoting Section 59 to draw reference to what is then the responsibility of the portfolio committee and subsequent parliament, not as a suggestion that they've not been consulted when certain mining policies have been developed. In the presentation of Makua, they make a reference to many statistics. They also make a reference to a research they've undertaken. I wanted to know that how accurate are the statistics that they are speaking about and whether they can be verifiable. I'm also would like to join Umam Malinga because it's quite worrisome, Chair, that there are 40% of women that jobs are only accessible through sexual favor. And in the main, we find that at most of the time, it's young women who are affected by this phenomenon. So in such an instance, I would encourage Imaku and Newamua that they must encourage women to report such cases and that Iwamua must play a critical role in this regard. Another issue elukutia sokolisa kakhulu sihlalo is the issue around the social labor plan. They estimate that almost 5.9 billion, which was supposed to be spent in affected communities, have not been spent in those communities. I would want to know from the department that what they've got to say about this particular phenomenon, because some of us who comes from mining areas, your Mirafong, your Kutsong, your Tlekdop, knows that the issue of social labor plans is a troublesome issue to our community. So what does the department have to say in response to that? I know that the mining charter now requires that they must be publicized. That companies must publicize such social labor plans. But I think I would want to know whether is the money that is intended for these social labor plans spent on them, Chair. Lastly, I know that the minister is saying he's not bothered by personal attacks by Makua and Wamua. But some of us discourage such, and I think we must say to Makua and Wamua that we discourage personalized attacks on ministers or any senior employees in government, because we feel that it compromises how we work together moving forward. So as a word of advice to Makua is that let's not engage in personalized attacks. If there are issues with the minister or with the department, let them be raised with affected parties without resorting to personal attacks, because that will compromise how we work moving forward. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Let me start just 10 minutes. Makua, can you, I'll give you 10 minutes to respond. And then we will give the department, and then I will suggest what should be the way forward, because I agree with members. I don't think the matter is going to be exhausted and be finalized today. We'll be doing an injustice to the process. Can I give in? I don't want to say, I saw that there is a hand by Michelle. I assume it's Mr. But sometimes Michelle can be a surname. I don't know. But I don't want to say who. That's in 10 minutes, Makua.
Okay. Thank you. Firstly, I would like to, Dorozo, that is, we as Makua, firstly, let me indicate that is the time given for us to engage compared to the time given to Eskom is a problem, because we're only given an hour. We look at Eskom is given 3 hours. That means...
No, wait, Chief. You can't tell the committee. There is a reason why. By the way, Eskom was all long scheduled. So please don't bring something that is going to make the meeting go way wide. There is a reason. Okay. That's why I said, we are not going to exhaust this thing today. That's
okay.
Exactly what
fine.
I said. Yes.
Okay. Okay. What I'm saying is, firstly, comrade, I'm worried that is.
Okay, wait, Honorable Maling. Sorry. Is it Michelle? Ne?
Yes.
Okay, sorry,
yeah,
Michelle. Yes, sorry. Honorable Malinga.
Yeah, thank you very much. Can the person on the platform not call the officials of the department by their first names? Please.
No. Okay, fine. Continue, Michelle. Sorry to call you, I don't know the same name, please.
My name is Meshack Mbangula, the national coordinator.
Okay, continue, Mr. Mbangula.
Yes, I'm saying firstly to respond to Ntokozo, the issuing of the licenses to us is one of the biggest problems, because I believe, as well as mentioned, that is, firstly, there are processes that need to be followed. And those processes are not followed correctly. Or the National Environmental Management Act is not done. And for the SLP, for the DMRE to be able to issue a license, it must make sure that the mine follow the process of social and labor plan, where it consults the communities. The SLP must be informed by the communities in hosting that mine to say, what is it that we want from the SLP? Thirdly, it's very important that the DMRE should be able to monitor what is in the SLP and is there any compliance? Because in most of cases, 99% or 95%, there's no non-compliance. The research that we have done, we call it social audits, where we went all over these provinces where there's mining. And we have those reports. We don't have a problem in giving those reports. We went out and take the SLP and check what is in the SLP for the communities. And we went down to the communities and look at each and everything that is in the SLP, whether it's there or not. And we questioned people on issues of batteries, even other places where they said they built at a school and all those things. In most of those places, people even don't even know. They were never even consulted by the mines. And we find it that very disturbing. That is, that should be itself not done. There was a question where we talked about, one, because there's no consultation to the people. People find themselves, that is, the mine might talk through the traditional leaders, and traditional leaders themselves don't even consult the people. And people find themselves, the traditional will sign away the land, and people will find themselves forcefully removed. And in other farm areas, KZN, Tendela mine, people have stock that they need a place for grazing. They find themselves forcefully removed because there was a dirty sign, and people are not consulted in that regard. People, if the mine is there, we find that is water get contaminated because people sometimes depend on the streams or rivers. And most of the heavy chemicals are split into the rivers, and that itself gives contaminated pollution and all that stuff. People don't even get employment. through our research that we have, we don't really assuming that this is happening. We have done that research. It takes us 10 of these mines that we have done, and we have that report with us. We are still continuing, as I speak, I'm in Kraluk, doing exactly that social and labor plan, trying to make sure that is we don't assume, but to give evidence to them. With the issue of women for sexual favors, if the DMRE can come down to, the thing is, people talk, we ask DMR to say, come and start monitoring. Do come and do monitoring on your SLP, on these issues that you are talking about. Then we'll be able, and we shouldn't be, ignorant, because we know very well that there are a lot of cases of women that have been reported. But what happened to the police station? Nothing happens to those issues. Some of our women are even afraid to go and report such issues because it's really not taken seriously. So we are saying it's important for us to engage and make sure that such things happen. And I mean, we even want to don't even understand what is an SLP, because the consultation and such, it's very low. We are prepared to give you, to start monitoring these mines, and let's go around and do monitoring. And that will be a very important thing. Lastly, the issue of DMRE went out, I don't know whether in Kenya or Kenya, and did a study of the artisanal miners there. That find it very strange, because that study should have been done in South Africa so that they can come up with the solutions of South Africa, not of other countries, so that you can have, because we believe that the unemployment rate in South Africa is growing so fast and it's very high. And we believe that is artisanal miners, so-called Zamazamas, those people part of potential of jobs that will help us to try. And for a comrade to say why as portfolio committee we want to engage them, I mean section 59, that's why we say it's section 59 to say we need this public hearing. For DMR to say they've gone to all the provinces, firstly with, let me talk about the MPRDA. They will come with a big document of MPRDA and say we're consulting the communities and give that document to the communities at 10 o'clock. 1 o'clock, they expect to say, yes, we agree with those. That's document, and give us the document by 10 o'clock, by 1 o'clock, they expect us to say, we understand what is in the MPRDA. Secondly, the most of those meetings are held in those areas to be able, the notice of the meeting to say on this date, people are informed today in the remote area, people, very few people attend such meetings and given a document that is so big and nobody understands what is happening. And that itself, do you call it a public hearing? No, to me it's not. Even with the charter, in most of those hearings when we got there, we were accusing, that is, we want to be part of the, when the charter is, starting with the charter, we should be part of that. Not you drop, you get a consultant and then drop the charter and then give it to us and say, this is what we have. We need to be there on the initiating stage where we can put our ideas. Over and above that, we gave them our people's mining charter that as we go through the presentation, we adopted in 2015 to say this is our charter and this is what we want to see in the people's mining charter. But as we check the people's the mining charter, that nothing much of what we adopted to be in the chart. So we're saying to the DMRE, you should be able to each and every town where there's mining, we have office of DMRE. So monitor the processes of consultation when the mining starts. But all those things are not happening. Let me give to my other comrades to add. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Can I just get in? I'm from Makua as well. The other issues that are also stressing us as communities is the enforcement and compliance by the DMRE. The DMRE seems to be promoting large-scale mining instead of regulating them. The only thing that they will be concerned about, it will be the mining to get the permit. The SLP, it is the document that is aimed at developing the mining communities when the mine starts to operate in their community. And there's also a document called EMP, of which is Environmental Management Plan. Those documents are not even shared, are not even implemented. And there's also an environmental impact assessment that should be done in the community, with the community, on the community. So those things are not even done to the communities. The DMRE is leaving all these things to be done by the mine and also the mines to monitor themselves, of which is something that we find irrational, that the mining companies should monitor themselves when it comes to enforcing compliance. We don't have any records from the DMRE until up to now, where they say this mine has been closed and now the year is the rehabilitation budget and this is how the rehabilitation is going to be done and it is going to start year and end year. So it is not only about SLP. That is why we are saying some of the parliamentarians, they are talking from the view of being in the parliament, not being from a lived experience. You cannot tell Makua that it should report any case where women are alleging that they are being asked for sexual favors. Where will we get those resources in the first place? Whereas the SAPS is also struggling, it's in the backlog of when it comes to those cases. We also have many problems. It's just that the time doesn't allow us to mention all the problems that we are facing on the ground. But what has happened since 1994? All the mining areas have turned into ghost towns. Where I'm living here in the place is full of sinkholes. Instead of putting a sinkhole sign, the mine will put a pothole sign on the road. There's been more accident on that road since from last year March. I have tried to report, I've tried to talk with the mine, and what I the only thing that I have gained from that, from my effort, is for my life to be under threat. From now on, as I'm talking to you now on, I cannot walk in the streets freely because I'm projected by this large scale mining as the person who is blocking developments to come into the area. Thank you. I will pause there.
And in addition, thanks. I'm Mugete from Kopani. I would like to say, Hori, in many communities, you know, the government may not have, you know, the capacity, you know, to undertake the due diligence required for a smooth transition in the ownership and to ensure robust ongoing monitoring and, you know, the oversight of this ensuring the provincial government honor, you know, commands and plans. So,
Your line is very bad, ma'am. Can I give the department to make a comment on the issues? Then I will suggest what will be the way forward on the matters that we raise. Eskom, please bear with us. We are just finalizing, wrapping up. I'm sure we'll be with you just now. The department, please.
Chairperson, let me make an offer. As you have heard from the DDGs, that we meet these organizations every time they want to meet us. I make that offer. If they want another meeting to engage us, we'll give them the 3 hours that is given to us for and talk to them, hear them out, engage with them. It is not a commitment that we'll give them everything they want. There are 16 DMRE offices in the country. Almost in every major mining town, there's a DMRE office. And I must demystify this thing of the charter presented by a consultant. The charter was developed internally at I think the only thing that will help is engagement. For example, allegation about no. What people don't know is that the discussion that is going on in no between the communities and the mine that has brought back stability is facilitated by the department. Because people must always appreciate the fact that if you go to an operating mine and you try to stop it, you are not wanting engagement. You are creating a crime scene because it doesn't work that way. We talked to that community and said to leadership, you engage with the government and have a discussion. They agreed and they now have a discussion which is giving them results. So a member here asked when will we engage? Engagement in the department is ongoing, is ongoing. We talk to people all the time. And if you can spend a day in the department, you will notice that we are having 3, 4, 5 meetings every day with various sectors of society. Now, the SLP and consultation, and then I'm asked this question, public participation is an imperative. SLP's consultation happens, and the portfolio should hold the department to account. That's why we come here all the time, Chairperson, is because we're not feeling bad when we are subjected to oversight by the department. We come here all the time. One other thing that we should also look into, this thing of SLPs, it's quite a big section. We're working on it. There are failures, but there's also greed where organized communities want to grab the money of SLPs for themselves. You get two young people, professionally looking, coming, and when they walk out of here, they drive vehicles. And that is never a subject of discussion. We must talk about it. Up to now, you remember, Chairperson, that at one point, women were not allowed in the mines, totally. We opened that in 1987 from zero. Today, 53,000 women are working in the mines. It's a low percentage, but we have 53,000 women working in the mines today, and that number is growing. The issue of sexual favors, department can intervene, but that is a crime. I don't know if we appreciate that. Gender-based violence and femicide on all its forms are classified as crime. So in this case, it is a police case to subject anybody on that. artisanal mining. Why do you go to other countries and leave us here for artisanal mining? You go and learn to people who are doing it already. That is scientific. You can't learn from the mistakes. Zama and illegal mining is not a mining activity, it's a criminal activity. And you must accept that if you want to deal with it directly. Let me conclude, Chairperson, by saying, Makua and Wamua must organize. 6,000 signed up members in mining communities is a drop in an ocean. But we'll take them serious, we'll engage them, but they're not a representative body. So, and they must appreciate that we'll talk to other people who represent others. 2019, I organized the mining union, which had 340,000 members. And then 6,000, it's a drop in an ocean. They must organize and have the muscle. Allow that there are others who are organizing in those communities, and we'll talk to them. Let me stop there and say, the right way to do it is they must come and talk to us and not get tired. We'll engage them. They were engaged during the MPRDA. They were engaged during the mining charter issues. They made their issues. They were making submission among many submissions that were there. But we'll meet them anytime they want to. And Togozo and Makubel are our point person. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Makua. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. Let me start with this thing. Look, when we engaged, can we, so that we all find solutions? The fact that I don't see or I don't get the point the way that you are, it doesn't mean we must demean people. Please, I'm just appealing to all of us. I may not understand, but once you come and plead your case, and then you fight with the same people that you are pleading your case to, it doesn't help the situation. Otherwise, you'll end up fighting with everyone. Now, I want to give you this assurance, Makua and Wamua. When you come to this committee, we have no interest of our own, but what we are tasked to do. So when you make the presentation, regardless whether I disagree with you or not, we are compelled to listen to you. And it is allowed of the process that if I don't understand, I must be engaged, I must be taken aboard so that I'm clear. So I think for me, the good thing now, we've got a sense of what are the issues. Now, let me start with the first thing. One, I'm trying to check before we close this period, this first quarter, we will need the department. In fact, by next week or a week after next, Honorable Minister, together with Makua, must confirm when is the meeting between the two is taking place. So that you iron out all the issues that are being raised here. Secondly, I will ask Mr. Guayama, through the presentation in particular that was made by Makua, just draw out issues that are supposed to be taken aboard by the committee, issues that might be broad enough that are taken up by Parliament, but also issues that transcend the committee. For an example, if there are issues, if we get a case that says there is a problem with the people reporting cases to the police station, I get someone who has even made an example now saying it's difficult for me to go out. The difficulty, it may not fall on this portfolio committee. It can either be a matter that must be referred to the speaker's office so that that matter can be referred to the relevant committee of parliament with these issues. Can that includes also cases of sexual harassment that must be a subject of investigation. Thirdly, we will go through these issues, Makua and Wamua. We will now schedule a meeting. In that meeting, we will know specifically what are the issues that you are raising. That's why it was important that listen for you from abstract. But now we will be dealing specifically, and it's going to be one of the issues we'll take into consideration in the first, in the second quarter of this year, which is between April and June. That's why we've got four quarters. It's going to be part of the issues we accommodate in the program. That includes issues about public participation. In most cases, legislation is very nature. It's compulsory for parliament to conduct public hearings through the process of public participation. You will recall, even in the MPRDA, one of the issues that was raised when there was the proposed amendment was that in as much as the National Assembly had done its work, public participation at an NCOP level was not undertaken, unfortunately, including consultation with the House, with the National House of Traditional Leaders. That was not from us. It's what was said in law. So we'll come back and deal with those issues. But I can also make this promise, because some of the issues I can see, they also relate to the role of provincial government and local government. We will try in that meeting to bring on board the select committee on rural resources, blah, 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 all those, because they've got many. They include rural development, agriculture, and so forth. But specifically on mining, we will bring the select committee of the NCOP so that now we deal comprehensively with all these issues that you have raised. If it needs be, we will take this thing when we have done it, throw it, send it back to yourselves, and then you can look at it, whether it captured most of the issues that we're supposed to deal with, so that when we have got an engagement, we have got an engagement that is proper and is much more informed. So we will come back to you most definitely before we go for, we finish this first quarter. We will come back to yourselves with a meeting, but we want yourselves now, together with the department, after next week, to have confirmed when yourselves as the two are going to meet, agree on issues, probably on the agenda items. The minister is making a commitment that unlike the 1 hour given here, you will get your 3 hours with the department so that you iron out. My advice also will be that please look at other issues from that meeting, Honorable Minister, at the department, and see whether some of these issues cannot, on your sister departments, find a way that they should participate. On that note, thank you very much. We will do that follow-up meeting, which now will be much more informed and more time for it. Let me say also, Makua, the reason is that we didn't want to go on recess to the first quarter without hearing what are the issues. So we had to squeeze you on this meeting because there is no other time. Unfortunately, meetings of parliament, unlike even the departments, they have got an advantage. Meetings of parliament, you apply for a meeting. Then the House Chairperson may accept or may not accept the date or the day that you are suggesting. So on that note, can we now go to ESCOM?
The over that.
In Dono Life, Vice Minister, I'm saying. Yeah, what is it?
Indeed. So when I'm meeting them, I go and Wamua,
yes.
Ufunastini, it date, Ibe Gwengwe.
And target the time, it must be confirmed. It's a committee meeting. Sorry for the exchange. We're saying.
I'm just checking so that when I leave here.
We want because it's in the committee, there is a need for us. So when no one questions the meeting, we say if at least by week after next we can get a confirmation when the meeting is going to be taking place. That's all. We're not putting a date. We're putting a confirmation of when the meeting will take place.
Okay, fine.
Okay. Can we go to Eskom, please?
Prof, will you introduce, please?
Good morning, Chair, and honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. I am Malegapuru Makhoba, the interim chair of ESCOM, and we are here on the invitation of the committee to make a presentation that will be led by the group chief executive and his team, I think to highlight some of the issues that have been raised by your committee. And we will make a presentation after which there will be interrogations and questions by members of the committee. And we look forward, I think, to a robust engagement so that we can learn and be informed. And also, I think the committee can learn as to what we are doing as ESCOM. I'm going to hand over the presentation to Andre De Reiter, the Group Chief Executive of ESCOM, unless the ministers are there to make some preliminary comments before we start the meeting. But we are grateful for the opportunity to present to the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, no, sorry, Prof. Okay, welcome, Prof, and your team. I'm sorry, I didn't notice. Is the minister or the deputy minister on the delegation? I should have done so.
Thank you, Chair. I think we're fine. The board is here, led by the interim chair as well as with the executive team. So without really much ado, I can just extend an apology. The minister is with SCOPA as we speak. So I am here on the part of the department. So with your permission, Chair, the presentation could be made. Thank you.
Okay. Now you can continue.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Deputy Minister. I think it is now the opportune moment, I think, for Andre De Reiter and his team to take us through the presentation. And I only appeal that they are succinct and to the point so that we don't spend our time waffling over things. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chair, Honourable Minister, other dignitaries and officials, and Honourable Members, thank you very much for the opportunity to present ESCOM's perspectives on clean coal technology to the committee this morning. It is a very important topic. We are very aware that we have an environmental impact with our operations, in particular with emissions and also the water use that we consume at our coal-fired power stations. ESCOM is going to remain a significant consumer of coal for a long period of time, given the fact that we are only now finalizing the commissioning of Medupi and Kusile, which are scheduled to be decommissioned by 2069, 2070, respectively. So it is very important that we do research and development into technologies that will allow us to mitigate the negative environmental impact that we have as a consequence of burning coal. The compliance with the minimum emission standards comes at a very significant cost. If we wanted to bring our current coal fleet into full compliance, we estimate that this will require us to invest an amount of some 300 billion rand over the next decade. And this is clearly not affordable, And we need to look for other opportunities and other solutions to our emission challenges. And we therefore are pursuing a number of initiatives in Eskom, one being the Just Energy Transition, which we trust will be the subject of a separate submission to this committee in due course. We would welcome that opportunity, Honourable Chair. And today we are going to talk about clean coal technologies. I'm joined by a number of our senior executives, but I would like to introduce, Chair, with your permission, the presenters today. We have asked the subject matter experts on this to join us. They are in order of appearance, Ms. Deirdre Herbst, who is the Senior Manager, Generation Environmental Management, Mr. Nashad Hariprasad, who is the Acting Senior Manager, Research, Testing and Development, Dr. Javita Juhaiditeit, Chief Scientist, Emission Control Technologies, and then Ms. Fulufelu Makananise, who is the Acting Middle Manager for Emission Control Technology. So these colleagues will take us through a presentation. It is short. We have taken notice of the guidance that we have received from the Eskom Chair, and we will try to be as brief and succinct as possible. So with that introduction, I would now like to hand over to Ms. Deirdre Herbst, who will take us through the first few slides.
Okay, good morning. Sorry, I had issues trying to unmute myself. Thank you for this opportunity, Chairman and Committee, to present on Eskom's environmental and clean coal technology options. I think the Chief Executive gave an excellent introduction to this slide, but I will just cover a couple of the key issues and then some of the impacts. Obviously, from a primary energy cost, almost 60% of our operating expenses, and any opportunity to reduce these costs will benefit Eskom and South Africa. What has influenced the environmental aspects is definitely legislation, so we are committed to comply with South African legislation, and the key part of legislation is the National Environmental Management Air Quality Act. And then we have the Paris Agreement on climate change, which requires us to reduce our greenhouse gases. We have the introduction of the carbon tax bill, which states that we should be, anybody that conducts activities in greenhouse gas emissions must pay a carbon tax. And then, of course, we are a water-scarce country and therefore need to optimize on our water usage. We mentioned that the full compliance of emission standards is going to cost up to 300 billion rand. Eskom has put forward a proposed phased approach, which will ensure that we reduce emissions through the decommissioning of plant, as well as putting emission retrofit projects in place. And we believe that we can find a much more cost-effective manner to add to this by introducing clean coal technologies and the just energy transition towards a cleaner energy, which will also contribute to the reduction in health impacts that we have in the Mpumalanga area. So this presentation is going to cover many of the research options that we have from a clean coal technology, and we will also, towards the end of the presentation, talk to the emission reduction program that we have. And also just remembering that as we decommission coal plants, we will see an improvement in the air quality in the Mpumalanga area specifically, and then an improvement in the health impact that we have in the Mpumalanga area. So the next slide is going to be presented by Nashad and he's going to cover some of the clean coal technologies. Nashad, over to you.
Thank you very much, Deirdre. Good morning, Chairman, Honourable Ministers, members of the committee, the GCE of Eskom, and other colleagues on board today. All protocols observed from my side. My duty today is to introduce you to the Clean Coal Technologies research portfolio within Eskom and give you an appreciation in terms of the work that is conducted within. The Clean Coal Technology is generally defined as any technology employed on new or existing fossil plants to reduce particulate, SOx, NOx, and CO2 emissions. The mandate of the research portfolio is to develop technology options that assist Eskom to implement solutions that have a positive environmental impact and or improve cost efficiencies as introduced by the GCE and touched by colleague Deirdre as well. We have the following areas in terms of clean coal technologies, and they essentially look at the overview of the control of oxides of sulfur, oxides of nitrogen, mercury, and particulates, which happen to be one particular space of clean coal technologies. We also have the carbon abatement portfolio that looks at the various elements inclusive of carbon capture and storage, utilization and storage, and fuel substitution. Overarching the elements is also affiliated to the plant performance and optimization. We will be overviewing these areas in detail by my colleagues through the presentation. It's quite important to note that in order to keep abreast of the continuously evolving technology landscape, it's imperative to track developments within the clean coal sector, thereby allowing me to move into the next slide. Within the space of the developments in emission control technologies for power sector and industrial processes, we have the focus as emission control technologies are a key element in unlocking compliance to the minimum emissions standard. Tracking of the following five technologies, as you are seeing represented on the left of your screen, top left of your screen, involves the focal areas of SOx, NOx, mercury, particulates, and multi-pollutant. The expansion of the SOx space looks at the varying technologies in terms of wet, semi-dry, dry flue gas desulfurization technologies and other novel opportunities in terms of dry sorbent injection, waste and byproduct stabilization is also investigated in the space. Within the NOx space, we look at the technology ambit of low NOx burners, selective, non-selective catalytic reduction. Within the mercury space, we are busy conducting the quantification of our source emissions and looking at technology opportunities in terms of activated carbon and pre-combustion additives to mitigate mercury should that be required upon the baselining of emissions within the Eskom coal fleet itself. The particulates space looks at technologies of the fabric filter plant, electrostatic precipitators, high frequency transformers, and yield conditioning. The multi-pollutant space talks to the techno-economic evaluation of the production of sulfuric acid utilizing multi-pollutant emission control technologies. It's important to note that these technologies are tracked by adhering to open market assessment to conduct the technology evaluation process as illustrated under the box of technology evaluation. We tend to go out and issue an open market inquiry by way of a request for information. We look at developing the technical requirements for what we would like to adjudicate. We conduct the technical evaluation, look at ranking the technologies, and then look at developing the technologies further by way of the techno-economic evaluation and make decisions in terms of proceeding into a pilot or demonstration plant if required. On a recent open market assessment that was issued in 2019, all five technology focus areas to ascertain the most recent technology status updates was undertaken. One of the key drivers was also the identification of multi-pollutant technology options for pilot application at Matimba Power Station. The Matimba multi-pollutant pilot, conjunction with the circulating fluidized bed demonstration plant and the dual flue gas conditioning demonstration plants, where conditions associated with the ESCOM minimum emission standard postponement application. One of the key constraints in expediting the developments of these deliverables were resource constraints as well, which plagues much of South Africa and SOCs currently. As an example, I'm going to be taking you through the circulating fluidized bed flue gas desulfurization and dual flue gas conditioning demonstration cases, which are further overviewed over the next two slides as we proceed into this. The first of the overviews in terms of cases is the circulating fluidized bed flue gas desulfurization demonstration plant at Kendall Power Station. As part of the ESCOM flue gas desulfurization fleet concept study, the CFB FGD was identified as the premier technology candidate given the operating parameters at Kendall Power Station. The CFB FGD is categorized as a semi-dry FGD technology as it does not consume any direct process water. However, the reagent employed is a hydrated lime. It consumes about 30% less water than conventional wet FGD. Other than a water saving, the technology provides the following technology benefits. It looks at operational flexibility in terms of the capability to handle a ranging variation of sulfur in fuel mixing and is more flexible than other technologies. The multi-pollutant control capability looks at the co-benefit of capturing other acid gases and mercury, which supports future air quality control requirements. The benefit of the technology also talks to the opportunity of a lower capex option in the frame that the CFB FGD retrofit is cost effective and a feasible solution given the dynamics of specific plant in ESCOM. The design can be optimized to realize a major cost saving, which will make the technology more competitive. Finally, the range of lime quality allows the technology to be capable of utilizing lower quality sorbent, which is a collective for limestones in the country, and allow for the scrubbing process, hence reducing OPEX. The demo plant will provide an insight on the range of lime quality that can be utilized. The timeline of the technology is effectively currently, we've taken a basic engineering design and have that concluded for the purpose of implementation of a demonstration plant. However, given that this is affiliated to the minimum emission standard postponement application, we are currently on hold for the execution of it and awaiting a decision point from DEF. The international reference plant experience is available on the particular technology and can be looked at under the technology maturity portion, where there are reference plants of in excess of 420 megawatts. We shall now transition to the next case in terms of demonstration, which moves into the dual flue gas conditioning demonstration slide. In the migration to meet the particulate matter 50 milligrams per normal meter cubed, some of the electrostatic precipitators employed in ESCOM are able to achieve this compliance. Where the ESP technology is not evaluated to meet the minimum emission standard, the fabric filter plant technology retrofit was identified to be a robust, tried and trusted long-term solution. However, this comes at a significant cost in terms of capital. The introduction through the ESCOM research process had the high frequency transformer demonstration enhancement at the Thaba Power Station in 2014, which led to the proof of the technology's capability within an ESCOM context. This had led to the rollout of the HFT on some ESP plants within the ESCOM coal fleet. Whilst it has been calculated that on some ESP plant where declining coal quality is significantly lower than the design coal, a supplementary enhancement to the addition of HFT is required. Hence, the introduction of this particular overview in terms of the dual flue gas conditioning demonstration initiative. The indicative testing of this particular demonstration, which was a indicative test conducted at the Thaba Power Station, resulted in less emissions of around 30% of particulates. Currently, this particular technology is at a demonstration phase and has been installed and commissioned at ESCOM's Tutuka Power Station, Unit 6, in December 2020. The plant is currently being optimized and has shown promising results to motivate for the demonstration to be converted to a semi-permanent plant and be coupled with the high-frequency transformer retrofit to cumulatively meet the minimum emission standards. The technology benefits additional to the CapEx saving to the FFP retrofit include outage duration. This is done by eliminating the need for a lengthy outage required for an FFP retrofit. The installation of the dual flue gas conditioning only requires a short opportunity outage to install. The rollout period of this particular technology has a full station opportunity in terms of all six units at the current Tutuka Power Station and in relatively a very short period, depending on the general overhaul window of opportunity to install. Finally, the ESP enhancements has significantly high potential to reduce emissions of the ESPs with regards to particulate matter emissions. The element of conclusion on these two cases allows me then to now yield to my colleagues to take you through the carbon abatement and plant performance and optimization technology focus areas within clean coal technologies, commencing with the carbon abatement focal area. Over to Dr. Jovita Yuadetite. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairman, Honorable Minister, and Honorable Members. Also, good morning to ESCOM colleagues as well. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to present the research overview of the work that we are doing in the research clean coal technology portfolio. I will take you through ESCOM's activities on carbon abatement, as Nausha said. The first area of discussion is carbon carbon capture, transport, utilization and storage. Eskom has been a member of South African Center for Carbon Capture and Storage, or SACS, how I will refer to it later, since 2009, since its inception. And one of the mandates of SACS is to provide commercial entities such as Eskom the sufficient information that will enable decisions to be made for the inclusion of CCS in their planning. So at the time of joining SACS, a decision was made by Eskom that Eskom would not independently research into carbon, specifically now carbon storage and transport options, but would rather coordinate all its efforts through SACS. SACS is also the implementing agency for South African roadmap for carbon capture and storage that was endorsed by the government and parliament. SACS to date produced the Atlas for Geological Storage in South Africa, and this atlas at that time indicated that theoretically that at least 1 gigaton of geological storage could be available, and this is more than 4 times the capacity required to store 240 million tons per year, say for 100 years. So the most of that storage is pertains to deep sea lane aquifers, with some extra options of depleted gas fields and enhanced callback methane recovery. As part of the roadmap, one of the milestones involves implementing a pilot scale injection program. And this program intends to demonstrate carbon dioxide handling, injection, storage, and monitoring in South African geology. Now, referring to the slide on your left-hand side, you can see that major storage options are either offshore or coastal, and the predominant source of carbon dioxide, or where all Eskom coal-fired power stations are, this is located inland. And that translates really into long distance transport options of captured carbon dioxide. Now, according to the recent evaluations done by International Energy Agency, that transportation using pipeline cost is somewhere between $2 and $6 per ton for 250 kilometers. And therefore, it's really highly cost prohibitive if you look at existing coal-fired power stations. Now, should coal-fired plants with CCS technologies become cost competitive with other generation technologies, the plants most probably would be located close to the storage facility, the coal transported to the plant rather than inland. And I need to mention here that definitely further development in these areas, particularly relating to long range transport and additional storage sites and options, could really play a major role in the project development site selection. So as I mentioned before, Eskom focus in this area is really largely now related to studies on carbon capture plants and the integration of these into fossil fuel power stations. Going a little bit into the past, you know, when we started all this research, Kusile environmental approval record of decisions required the plant to be made CCS ready, carbon capture and storage ready. This request predated, definitely predated the development of the Atlas, and the plant was therefore made ready to incorporate carbon capture technologies on site, but did not consider at that time transportation and storage or sequestration because there was no information really available at that time. So Eskom started technologies, carbon capture technology assessments at that time to support the compliance with this requirement. And other work done by Eskom to evaluate carbon capture technology options include also, for example, techno-economic assessment of inland coal stations versus coastal coal stations with and without CCS. Eskom later joined the project that was funded by European Commission, Seventh Framework Program, which was called Octavius, that stands for optimization of CO2 capture technology, allowing verification and implementation at utility scale, which was made up of international consortium of members. So the consortium then conducted techno-economic assessments of amine-based capture technologies and integration with the coal-fired power stations. Eskom was specifically the responsible to undertake studies on the integration of carbon capture and compression into plants that utilize dry cooling, and utilize an existing Eskom's plant as a reference. And the latest development on carbon capture was initiative that was proposed by World Bank to explore the options of possible pilot plant in South Africa at one of the Eskom sites. That was done through SACS. Eskom was providing input into the development of user requirements for the pre-feasibility studies to be conducted. The pilot was intended to be national or even regional facility to support further R&D, research and development in this carbon capture area. This project, however, unlikely to proceed further. Currently, there are no active projects that's being executed by Eskom in this area. However, I must say that we will continue to do periodic scans on the development of the technology and its techno-economic development. Here I would like to move on the next slide, please. So another carbon abatement option, which does not require CCS, is the use of biomass as a fuel source. This option has been investigated in Eskom since 2010. So it's quite a long time period. When it was identified as a strategic initiative. So the preferred option for utilizing biomass in Eskom has always been to consider co-firing or possible conversion of the existing power stations. So there are clear, obviously, benefits of biomass, and it is a dispatchable renewable option, which does not require investment of backup power. It also offers high capacity factors and lower capex costs compared to other carbon abatement or even some renewable technologies. And it's cheaper than new built, say, biomass plants. So Eskom has done several studies to pursue these options. These studies include both internal R&D as well as collaborative work with international bodies, such as, for example, International Energy Agency's Bioenergy Technology Collaboration Program, where Eskom participated specifically in a task 32 that looked into biomass combustion and co-firing. So this collaboration was quite technical and produced several good results. It's not on a slide, but I would like to mention also IEA, Clean Coal Center. We are a member of that technology collaboration program. And in their high efficiency, low emission portfolio, they are also looking into biomass co-combustion with coal. Another project that I would like to mention, which is an important project that Eskom participated in, is Biomass Action Plan for Electricity Production in South Africa, or BAPEPSA. So Eskom participated in this intergovernmental study. The study was between the Netherlands and South Africa. It brought really a team of experts from both countries and from government, from industry, from academia, as you can see on the slide. From Netherlands side, participation was from Netherlands Enterprise Agency and Embassy of the Netherlands. From our South African side, two departments, Department of Public Enterprises and Department of Energy, how it was called at that time. So the project was designed to determine appropriate biomass targets, biomass availability, biomass conversion technologies and upgrading technologies, look into markets, and also look into barriers for market deployment. And that was done as a first phase of this project. As a second phase of the project, we utilized this information to develop the biomass action plan. And it looked into solutions for the barriers we identified in the first phase, formulation of priorities, formulation of actions and scenarios for the development of market opportunities in South Africa. So now assessment of these market opportunities was done through various, we looked into all possible biomass value chains. We shortlisted those value chains and did a detailed assessment on selected value chains. For example, if it's at utility scale, it would be forestry residue and biomass coal firing. If it's industrial scale, we looked at invasive alien plants and combined heat and power. We looked at agricultural residues with sugarcane. Also small off-grid applications, digestion, biodigestion, co-digestion, and biogas. So the conclusion of the study recommended the introduction of national demonstration plans to overcome some of those barriers that we identified for to biomass utilization in South Africa. And the demonstration plan that was recommended for utility scale application in this project was co-firing of processed or upgraded biomass at an existing facility. I would like to move to the next slide, please. So, as I mentioned, so that translated to some projects what ESCOM is undertaking in biomass. So ESCOM's investigations into, like I said, into biomass coal firing started long ago, and initially it started by considering the use of conventional wood pellets or white biomass, but later the projects evolved into a preference for utilization of torrefied wood pellets. The project was set up as a collaboration between state-owned companies, and it was ESCOM, South African Forestry Company, SAFCOL, and Industry and Development Corporation, IDC. The SAFCOL being the supplier of the raw material and utilizing a stranded asset that was owned by IDC, and the stranded asset could be converted into a torrefaction facility to process forestry residues into a torrefied product. And ESCOM, yeah, obviously would be the off-taker. And in this project, ESCOM identified its Arnold Power Station as the most suitable site to implement this co-firing project. So just to mention a little bit the benefits of torrefied biomass. So the benefits are that it has high energy density. So this translates into lower transport costs. And this is now particularly important given the distances between biomass resources in South Africa and existing coal-fired power stations. But it also, when you consider, biomass for a large-scale implementation, so it is likely that the biomass would need to be sourced from within the region. So that's all these benefits. When you look at physical and chemical properties of torrefied products that are closer to coal, so that means it requires significant less capital cost to integrate this co-firing into a power station operation. Another important aspect to consider is obviously it's related to the socioeconomic impact, and this is in a form of long-term job creation in rural areas, and this comes from forestry sector, obviously from collection of biomass residue, and also it comes from biomass processing plants as well. So the current status of the project is that we have completed the biomass sourcing initiative. These were performed by SAFCOL, confirming that they could provide sufficient biomass to produce 80,000 tons per year of pellets. That actually corresponds 5% co-firing at one unit at Arnot. So samples of statical biomass were tested to determine the suitability for torrefaction, and that we received positive results. We did feasibility study, basically design study that was performed on the conversion of IDC's zebra pellet plant in Sabi to convert it into a torrefaction facility. Also, ESCOM performed its laboratory capabilities assessment to test biomass, and we performed basic engineering to determine the requirements for Arnot plant modifications to incorporate this biomass for firing and also the cost associated. So the activities still remaining that are still remaining is really finalization of the project structure, ownership structure, funding structure, raw material, offtake agreements, and then, yeah, business case approvals based on the outcome of the project structure. So I also want to mention that in parallel to this, we are also exploring alternative technology uses. And we are looking at semi-mobile plants to produce, in this case now, we are looking to produce the smaller, much smaller plant to produce 1 ton per hour product instead of 10 tons per hour, which is for Arnot project. And this would be for the test burn that identify power station, much smaller station, could be Komati, for example. And we are looking to use forestry residue and supplement it this invasive alien plant, where we are now in collaboration with this Working for Water program. This project is subject to the successful application and approval of research proposal, which we submitted answering European Commission's Horizon 2020 framework program call, which was accelerating the green transition and energy access partnership with Africa. So the project proposal is called Green Africa, which stands for greenification and decarbonization solutions for African continent. It will be a consortium of members as well, not just from South Africa, from other African countries as well. So at this point in time, I would like to thank you for your attention. And I think I will now hand over back to my colleague Fulu Fellow. She will introduce plant performance and optimization activities. Thank you.
Thank you, Jovita. Good morning, Chair, Honorable Ministers, and the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee, the ESCOM Chairman, our GCE, my ESCOM colleagues, all protocols observed on my side. Thank you for this opportunity. So in terms of the plant performance and optimization focus area, the first item there is the low fuel igniters. This looks to address the issue of high fuel oil usage. And then we're looking into two technologies. The first technology there being the mini oil guns technology. This one here looks to reduce fuel oil consumption. And then the second one there is the plasma technology, which looks to eliminate the fuel oil usage altogether. And then with these technologies, they happen during, or they are applicable during startups, shutdowns, as well as during low load operation. These technologies carry with them benefits in terms of cost savings, where the fuel oil usage is either reduced or eliminated in terms of the plasma technology. There's also a fast return on investment, where we eliminate the inventory fuel oil costs in terms of retrofit projects, or we eliminate the entire supplementary fuel oil storage and handling systems in terms of new projects. The next aspect there has to do with operational flexibility, where these technologies assist in terms of being readily available to support the flexible operation of coal-fired power plants. We know now that the country is currently in the process of introducing renewable energy resources into the grid. And this carries with it challenges in terms of grid stability. So operational flexibility involves faster tabs and quick ramp rates. So these technologies come in very handy in terms of the ability to do faster tabs and quickly ramp to higher loads. The last benefit there has to do with fuel flexibility, where these technologies can operate with low rent coals, high volatile hard coals, as well as coal dust or biomass. So in terms of the timelines of the project, unfortunately, the project was delayed. We are looking into demonstrating one of these technologies. We had issued an RFI into the market in 2019, and we had suppliers, international suppliers, that responded to the RFI, and they were due to come to the country and do plant assessments. But unfortunately, because of the COVID situation, they could not come. So we are looking to continue with the project, depending on how the COVID situation goes. We will look to evaluate and see how we move forward in terms of this project. Can you please move on to the next slide? So the second item there in under plant performance and optimization focus area is thermal efficiency and resource utilization. Thermal efficiency looks into optimization of plant performance in our coal fleet. It is largely dependent on the mechanical performance of our coal plants. And as you can see in the graph there, the bar graph of generation thermal efficiency, the efficiency is highest in the winter months, and this is due to dry coal utilization as well as low ambient temperatures. The low ambient temperatures assist with our cooling systems at the back end of the turbine. In terms of the benefits of thermal efficiency, this assists in terms of reducing coal utilization per megawatt of electricity generated. And obviously the reduction in coal utilization links to reduction in primary energy costs. And then when you reduce the coal utilization, you also reduce the amount of emissions produced per megawatt of electricity generation. And then as you improve the thermal efficiency, you also reduce the fuel oil usage because there will be no need for frequent support to the plant or to the milling plant. So if you look at the left-hand side of the slide in terms of the fuel oil utilization, you will see in terms of the blue parts of the graph, we have managed to reduce our coal fuel oil consumption in the last 10 months by about 78,000 tons. And we aspire to reduce the fuel oil usage to about 30,000 tons per month by financial year 2024. So still on the coal utilization part, we know that the quality of coal has a major impact on thermal efficiency. So we are looking into online coal analysis that produces instantaneous data that can assist with quick decisions based on better understanding of the coal quality impact in our power stations. So we don't have to wait for sending the coal samples to laboratories. We get the actual CV during the process, and we are able to decide on that. We're also looking into research initiatives relating to fine coal and novel coal beneficiation techniques to improve coal quality further towards meeting the minimum emission standard. So with the coal beneficiation, we have recently issued an RFI into the market, and this is looking into coal sulfur removal technologies, and we will be evaluating these technologies. Can you please move on to the next slide? And then we have Horizon 2020 projects, as well as the International Energy Agency's Clean Coal Center partnerships. So the Horizon 2020 is the biggest European Union framework program for research and innovation, with about 80 billion euros of funding that was available in the last 7 years up until last year. So our South African government has a partnership with the European Union, and ESCOM is utilizing this partnership, and we have joined the stakeholder community on matching and CAPWA, and this allows us to access the project results in terms of these projects. So matching is materials and technology for performance improvement of cooling systems performance in power plants, and it is a collaborative project which aims to reduce the cooling water demand in the energy sector. The CAPWA, it looks to capture evaporated water with novel membranes. It's also a collaborative project and is a continuation from a previously successful project which was funded over the period of 3 years up until 2013. So with the IEA CCC, this looks to promote best practice in all aspects of coal production, transport, processing, and utilization. So it focuses on high efficiency, low emission technologies. ESCOM is participating in terms of webinars. We're also reviewing the technologies that are there. Can you please move on to the next slide? The last aspect of plant performance and optimization is the implementation of dry cooling technology. This one here looks at minimizing the utilization of water through the cooling systems or cooling technologies at the back end of our plant. So if we look at the table there, it compares the different technologies, looking at your open cycle evaporative cooling, as well as your natural draft and forced draft dry cooling technologies. So yes, majority of the ESCOM technologies are still on the open cycle evaporative cooling, but we are moving to dry cooled technologies, and we have started with the move from wet cooling to dry cooling technologies since the 1970s during the times of fruit flame. So if you look at, for example, the forced draft cooling technology in terms of the average water consumption, that is consuming 0.14 liters per kilowatt hour of generated electricity against the 1.9 liters per kilowatt hour of generated electricity. That is a huge difference. So if, for example, we were to look at, say, a station producing 3,000 megawatt hour of electricity, if we look at the forced draft dry cooling technology, we are looking at about 300 megaliters per month in terms of water consumption against a 4,100 megaliters per month of water. So that is a huge difference. We've got dry cooled stations like your Majuba Power Station, Kenda, which uses indirect dry cooling. We've got your Matimba in terms of the existing power stations. And then the new build power stations, your Midupi and Kusile, definitely are using the dry cooled technologies. So as we decommission the old plants, the total water consumption will reduce. So in terms of the technologies that we're looking at with water reduction, this is a transition from, I mentioned CAPWA, I mentioned the matching with partnerships with the European Union. So those give us opportunity to look into what technologies are out there, and we evaluate those. Yeah, I think This is my last slide. I will hand over back to Noshad. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kudu. All protocols remain in observance from my side. One of my briefs is also to convey to the committee the underground coal gasification demonstration, which is essentially a novel technology to access unminable coal deposits in South Africa. The technology itself, by way of its background, is that the gas cleaning plant and condensate separation plant for a 15,000 normal cubic meter per hour co-firing demonstration had been commissioned. The mine production of the underground coal gasification is linked to a co-firing demonstration at Majuba Power Station's Unit 4. And the initial co-firing at Majuba Power Station was achieved in 2010. In terms of the technology and where it stands currently, we are currently looking at partnerships and looking at entering into a partnership as Eskom has not entered into many overall partnerships and specifically within the space of research and development to commercial technologies. And UCG is one of the first in the current era. The partnerships of R&D projects do have additional complexity due to the development, risk allocation, and intellectual property management in a shared partnership entity. And therefore, Eskom and RT&D need to benchmark the process, experience, and learnings for this strategic partnerships within a special purpose vehicle, joint venture, particularly with the development, ownership, management of the intellectual property against both R&D and commercial needs. To date, there's been an investment of 1.4 billion rands over 18 years in the UCG development, and certainly the option to leverage and the opportunity of alternatives in terms of an SPV, JV partnership, and the full decommissioning are all being considered in parallel. It is an important caveat to note on this particular demonstration that the commercial and financial viability of this technology has not been conclusively assessed at this point, and this needs to be completed first before further funds can be spent on underground coal gasification. This brings me to the end of the Clean Coal Technologies overview of the research portfolio. I am now going to yield over to colleague Deirdre Herbst to take you over the emission retrofit program before I conclude.
Thank you, Noshad. So I did speak to the emission reduction plan in the first slide and mentioned that a full compliance would cost up to 300 billion. That's obviously not affordable. And would result in itself in a 7 to 10% increase in the electricity tariff. Eskom in 2014 developed a plan to have a phased approach. So we focused on high emitting stations, and we also focused on particulate emissions, because particulate emissions is the pollutant that contributes to the most significant health impact in the Mpumalanga area. So what you can see in this picture is the list of power stations, Camden, Duva, Grootvlei, Kendall, that we are doing projects on, right in the left-hand column. And then you will see projects. Now, the projects are based on reduction of particulate emissions. And in that case, we would either retrofit with a fabric filter plant or electrostatic precipitators to reduce the amount of particulates that go out of the stack. The other pollutant that we try and reduce is NOx, and for that we introduce low NOx burners, or there are other technologies such as low NOx burners with overfire air, which would be required to bring the NOx emissions down to the limit that is stipulated in the minimum emission standards. And then lastly, and you've heard a lot of the discussion about flue gas desulfurization and the research projects, but we obviously also have the FGD project at Medupi. And when you're looking at the cost of these technologies, the fabric filter plants and electrostatic precipitators would cost between 2 and 6 billion rand per power station. If you're looking at the low NOx burners, you would also be looking at between 1 and 2 billion rand per power station. And the flue gas desulfurization, which has the most significant cost, would be between 30 and 40 billion rand per power station. So what you will see in this plan is that our plan is to work on particulate emissions, do reduction of NOx at some stations, and reduction of sulfur dioxide at Medupi with an FGD technology. You've also heard the team talk about looking at alternatives to reduce the sulfur emissions at Medupi. Some of them would be FGD, others would be looking at removing the sulfur from the coal and reducing the emissions through those mechanisms. Some of the technologies are already commercial and could be implemented. Other technologies still need to be researched and studied. But what's most important, if you see the graph, and I've just used an example where I'm showing what the NOx emissions over the next few years would be up until 2050, you'll see there's a significant reduction in NOx of about 43%, and this is achieved through the decommissioning of plant and then also introducing some of the retrofit projects. And what it demonstrates, and you get a very similar picture for NOx, SOx and particulates, it demonstrates as we decommission the stations, move over into the just energy transition, introducing renewable technologies and other clean coal technologies, that automatically you are significantly reducing the pollutants that we currently would emit into the atmosphere. So the most effective way of reducing emissions would be through the decommissioning of plant as they reach their 50-year life, and then added to that some of the retrofit projects which are demonstrated in this table. Sorry, I didn't get the question.
No, continue, ma'am. Continue.
Okay, so thank you. I thought it was a question. So what I can say on the emission retrofit dashboard is that we are progressing with many of these projects. For example, the Camp and Lonoff burners have been completed. We previously finished projects on first phase. And on the other power stations, we are making some good progress. Kendall is currently busy retrofitting ESPs on units 5 and 6. And many of the other stations are either retrofitting with the high frequency power supplies, and in some cases, the ESP upgrades are far advanced in the procurement processes. So we are a little delayed in some of these projects, but we are making some progress in the execution of the projects. Thank you, Chair. That's all from my side.
Thank you very much, Deirdre. A final concluding slide from the Eskom end in terms of the summary of the technology comparison. All protocols remain in observance from my end. So with the overview of the preceding clean coal technologies, brings us to the key question as to whether these can adhere to the minimum emission standard, and whether as part of our unfolding retrofit program that may span even farther, whether these can actually provide an avenue of cost effectiveness as we proceed. That's this particular qualitative technology comparison is provided for your benefit. It illustrates on the left-hand column the clean coal technologies that have been overviewed in today's presentation, one by one. It then looks at the affiliation to either particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, oxide of nitrogen, and then looking at whether these are essentially going to be cost effective and can be compliant or not. The process of evaluation talks to the first element of technology, which is the wet flue gas desulfurization, wet FGD. It is not a technology that is primarily employed for the reduction of particulate matters or oxides of nitrogen. Its primary purpose is to reduce sulfur dioxide, and that it is able to do and meet the minimum emission standard of 1,000 milligrams per normal meter cubed. The technology, however, provides us with a dilemma in an emerging country where affordability is certainly an issue. And with its high CapEx affiliation, it's one that needs to be looked at from alternatives. And Eskom is essentially looking at that currently through various mechanisms and mediums. And then the following two technologies of the CFB FGD and the dry sorbent injection FGD talk to technologies that have been overviewed and reviewed by research over the years, offer an opportunity to meet the minimum emission standard, but maybe and is site specific. So it's a case of looking at the operating parameters, your coal quality associated with the plant performance parameters, and then affiliating the correct technology. And you find in some instances, such as the dry sorbent injection, its application may not necessarily be able to conform with the 1,000 milligrams per normal meter cube in terms of the minimum emission standard, but may offer some other benefits in terms of partial reduction if it needs to be coupled with other emerging technologies. A case in point would be if coal pretreatment was a viable option through the investigation of the research process in terms of coal sulfur reduction, but it needs to have an additionality of top up on sulfur reduction. The dry sorbent injection could come into play pending the techno-economics of the coupling. Similarly, in the particulate matter area, the ESP plus HFT does, from a modeling perspective, offer the adherence to the 50 milligrams per normal meter cube. And I stress from a modeling perspective, as we're currently in the employment of the demonstration project at Tatuka Power Station on Unit 6, it will be coupled with the high frequency transformer, whereafter we would be able to prove our hypothesis or objective to meet the 50 milligrams on a singular unit and look at that as a rollout combination to meet minimum emission standard moving ahead. So we have these opportunities in the landscape of research. Deirdre has touched on in terms of the low NOx burners. We have that in employment on some of our plant by way of retrofit in Eskom. The beauty of where we stand with matters as far as the selective catalytic reduction and non-catalytic reduction are not technologies, although they meet the MES, are required from a South African context given our coal and configuration of plants. So the low NOx burners offers us the opportunity to meet on specific stations where we are required to retrofit, and on other stations where we have tangential fired burners and low NOx boiler configuration, we are able to meet the minimum emission standard compliance of NOx. Multi-pollutants, it's currently a technology there for development within the research space to be determined. It has potentially a very high CapEx, but has the opportunities of reducing water consumption substantially in relation to wet flue gas desulfurization, but potentially having a higher CapEx, and then looking at the benefits of the utilization of its byproduct depending on that particular variant. Carbon capture and sequestration, all of our minimum emission standards as it stands would need to be bolstered up with work that has been done with the Horizon 2020 overviewed by Jovita with Octavius, we've understood from a technology and plant design perspective, we would need to top up the reduction of our particulate matter, sulfur dioxide, and oxides of nitrogen substantially, as you would have contamination of the reagent used within the carbon capture plant itself and would lend it inefficient. Hence, you would need to have topping cycles to actually reduce your emissions even further. Hence, it's illustrated as prerequisites of the 50 milligrams as an example of particulate matter plus more, taking it potentially down to between 15 to 20 milligrams. It does have a significant penalty. Comes in at a 10 percentage point reduction in efficiency, which Fulu has overviewed, and that has a direct translation also in terms of higher capital costs. And from a South African perspective, two key elements prevail. One, we in the process of looking to prove storage with association with the carbon capture national initiative, and also in locality of our coal-fired plants and where the potential of major storage resides, either off coast or along the coast, those distances in terms of pipeline transportation are significantly prohibitive. Biomass co-firing does provide the opportunity in terms of being compliant, but is subject to the percentage co-firing that you would append on a coal-fired power plant. If you were to use biomass in its standalone fuel source, it would be compliant with the minimum emission standard. However, you're then referring to having sufficient biomass to be able to do that. And it does come in at a cost in terms of techno-economics that needs to be weighed in terms of the landscape of its baseload potential and how it fits in terms of the just energy transition and addition of the renewable energy penetration. Lastly, the use underground coal gasification as stipulated and disclaimed by myself, all of the affiliations are to be determined and is likely to be investigated with also a partnering opportunity as well. Colleagues, I would like to conclude by stating the following. The technology options do not offer a silver bullet solution that has been presented here for you today. If the state of our existing plant has not been addressed near optimal operation and design operating conditions, then we cannot expect the solutions of these technologies to overcome and override the existing state of plant and where it resides at. There's significant work that's being done on plant as conveyed by our GCE to media in frequent updates, and we hope for that to be coupled with clean coal technologies moving forward, that would then be able to meet minimum emission standards if techno-economically viable. It's also important to note that both maintenance and skills are imperative to achieve the aforementioned. And similarly, development and introduction of clean coal technologies also requires its association of the right skills for the development and implementation thereof. Hence, the solutions and timelines offered from clean coal technologies to meet the minimum emission standard is predicated on the state of existing plant getting up to near design condition in conjunction with resources and processes that need to be followed. I would like to thank you on behalf of the Eskom team that's here today and the extended team that contributes to all of the fantastic work that has been overviewed by ourselves today. And on that matter, I would like to thank you for your attention in obtaining an appraisal of Eskom's clean coal technology portfolio.
I would now like to yield back to the Eskom Group Chief Executive through to the Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chair, I trust that this presentation has given the committee an adequate briefing on the questions raised by yourselves, but we are at your disposal to answer any questions that you might have, and we submit to your guidance in this matter. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, DM and Prof and the GCO and your team for the presentation. Notwithstanding that there is the Deputy Minister in the house, but you know, Prof, when Prof says, which is the last qualification, the highest quality, when he says it's going to be short, this time around I've learned that short is a subjective term. But thanks for the presentation. The reason I didn't stop, honorable members, is that I wanted us to get all the information that is required so that we don't say when you ask, in my previous life, there was an easy thing. You ask a question, I say, because I did not finish, I would have said 1, 2, and 3. So just please bear with us. Knowledge is very critical. And I always say that lack of it can be too expensive and very costly. So I'm sure now we will move from a much more informed position in relation to the matters that are being done. We're negotiating. I think we will get time. We've got some time. Don't panic. Once we were listening on the other side, we were trying to sort out our own stuff with regards to the time. So just in simple exercise, Deputy Minister, if you are still in the house, we are different or we are common, different or common with other committees. We prefer that someone once said, carry a pen and a paper. We don't do dialogue. We ask questions, all members. It's important then that your team must take the questions or the comments. Based on those comments and the questions, you will decide which question goes to who must respond on this particular question. It assists and fast-tracks the meeting than one question, and then when you answer, I say, no, I do a follow-up. It ends up being a dialogue between two people. So you just carry a pen and a paper, or these days we say for IR, thanks to COVID, now we even know that you can run meetings far from each other. So we can use technology. It's not just literally a pen and a paper. We'll use the technology at our disposal. Honorable members, are there any hands? Let me check. I see Honorable Mashaule. I see no one. Oh, I see Honorable Matogwe. Okay, I won't come back. I won't come.
Mr. Milam as well.
Yes, I said Honorable Mashaule, Honorable Milam, Honorable Matogwe. No other one. Okay. I won't come back until Honorable Matogwe is done. But Mashaule, Kal, Honorable Milam, follow. Honorable Matogwe will follow. I will come back after Honorable Matogwe.
Thank you very much, Chair, and greetings to you, and request that may I switch off the video because of I don't have the best of the network coverage where I am, with your indulgence, Chair. I'll then greet the Minister Mandashe, if he's still on the platform, Deputy Minister Maswale, DG of Mineral Resources and Energy, the Chair of ESCOM, Prof. Malekapuru Makhoba, my former Vice Chancellor at the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and the CEO Director. Chair, let me start by saying that, you see, the Americans have had 4 years of being run through Twitter, and we have realized that Twitter can be an important tool to communicate messages, whether they are policy related or not. And I'm making this point, Chair, because if I mention anyone by their first name, it may be because I can't pronounce the second name, and may I be forgiven. But I think it's Haris Persad who mentioned that they have been investigating the latest technologies available. I want to invite him to some Twitter conversation that was written by one of the most important, richest people in the world, Elon Musk, who wrote on Twitter that he is donating $100 million towards the prize for best carbon capture technology. Now, there have been many responses in that regard, but what stood out amongst these responses was one response by a commentator on Twitter called Sizwe Dlomo. Sizwe Dlomo says, as fate would have it, the technology you seek already exists. And funny enough, not too far from where you were born. And he was referring to Pretoria, because Elon Musk, as you recall, has just became the richest person or South African on earth. He is being told that that 100 million, you can better utilize it in your country, because that's where the best technology is, in Pretoria. Now, the first question to ESCOM through Mr. Haris Perad or Mrs., I forgot. Have you taken time to investigate this point in Pretoria, just under our nose? And I'll forgive you that not everybody is on Twitter. Now that you know it, are you willing to investigate it? And some conversations where saying that there is a beautiful plant there that this technology is placed. Will you be willing to go and visit the plant and see the beautiful technology that they are talking about? The second question, Chair, is that let's all agree that the 300 billion that was mentioned earlier in the presentation is a huge amount of money for ESCOM to can carry. Yet we also understand that we can't accept the environmental situation in the current form it is in now. Is there no way to bring investors to take on this challenge of a 300 billion? Because ESCOM can't carry this, can't even carry 10 billion. It needs a bailout. The second question to that question is that are there companies out there or anyone, including Elon Musk, who are willing to provide emission remediation as a service to ESCOM? Or is there somebody, as we speak, providing such to ESCOM? The third question, Chair, and I'm going to be a bit longer because the presentation was very long as well. You'll bear with me, Chair. Now, based on the list of technologies that were presented here, I can't remember who highlighted it, but it was highlighted that South Africa is a water scarce country. Can it be best explained among the technologies that were identified or presented here, which technology is more efficient in terms of our water scarcity? The fourth question, really, has Eskom considered available local modular technologies for desulfurization that can be applied to the plant and enough? If not, we're asking why not? Any plant, can be candle, can be whatever. Do we have an available local modular technology to do this desulfurization? The fifth point or question is that in the presentation, all desulfurization solutions which are considered by Eskom were said to be having a high upfront capex that Eskom itself will have to fund. And the estimation, not Eskom's estimation, the estimation I have made can be at 19.9 to actually 20 billion US dollars, which Eskom does not have. And I doubt that Eskom will have in the near future. And that
Oh, we've lost you.
Am I lost?
A little bit.
Okay, let me eat on question five. Prof?
Yes, it's on question
five.
Yes,
we hear you now.
Yeah.
Okay. I was saying the solutions that were provided here of desulfurization, which Eskom is considering, happens to have high upfront capex that, in my view, Eskom will have to fund but doesn't have the money to fund. And I'm saying the estimation is around 20 billion US dollars, which Eskom in the near future will not have. Maybe in 5 to 10 years, 20 years, it will have. If there was somebody who is bringing an OPEX-based desulfurization technology, would Eskom consider that solution? That was the fifth question. The sixth question, again, it goes to Nashad Harisperat, and I apologize again, who mentioned that the CFB is cost effective. Now, if it's cost effective, how would it impact on the 300 billion that was mentioned earlier? And who does he anticipate that will fund this 300 billion. The last question goes to, I think, Ms. Jovita. I can't pronounce the surname, my apology. And we want to thank her for the update on the carbon capture. But given the exploratory nature of Eskom's work on carbon abatement, am I to understand correctly that The 300 billion presented at the opening of this presentation for emissions remediation does not include the carbon abatement, but rather focuses on other toxic emissions. Again, and this is the last point, to Ms. Jovita. You know, when you were presenting, I'm sitting with three gadgets here, and I quickly went to Google. And just by the browse of it, it became clear that whether it's the Financial Times, Bloomberg, what comes clear is that biomass are actually more polluting than coal. It's on Google. If you can go now, you will get it. Why would we consider such technologies when other G20 countries are already discounting those technologies? Chair, I had some questions, but let me prioritize these ones so that if there is a need, one makes a follow-up and let other members ask questions, because it was quite a long presentation and it was giving us information in abundance. So one had to prioritize which questions to ask. Thank you very much.
Honorable Mailam.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, Honorable Maswale has covered a lot of questions and some that I was going to cover, but I think I'd distill one of his big comments, which was about the cost implications. He spoke about the 300 billion rand. And so my question, and I'm going to put this to Mr. Derater, is how will Eskom fund the emission control that it is required to put in place given its current financial situation? The second question, there was a comment made that the cost implications for consumers would be about a 7% increase in electricity tariffs. And I find that very difficult to believe. You know, if we're talking 300 billion rand additional capital expenditure, how does that equate to a 7% increase? And if it doesn't, can you please correct me and tell me what are the cost implications for consumers? Then my next question is, given all of this, what is the likelihood of emission retrofit projects actually occurring in the near future? Especially given that, for example, Medupi still doesn't have a flue gas desulfurization unit, despite the fact that it was a criteria of the original World Bank loan. So, I mean, we're actually in breach of the conditions of our loan, but we're not going anywhere to put that in place. Then, on a more broad and general perspective, is clean coal a cost-effective solution against other generation technologies? And that's a very, very broad question, and I'd like some clarity on that. There's been a number of slides where you spoke about demo plants here, there, and everywhere for different technologies that you're considering. Are any of those operational, and if so, could we see them? I also note that there was slide 23, where work had been done to retrofit Camden and Grootvlei. Now, both of those power stations are due for almost immediate decommissioning. I think Grootvlei is now, and Camden is 2024. Can you explain why you are investing in power plants that you are actually looking to decommission in the short term? And then my last question, Chairperson, is on slide 16. There was a graph there where there was talk about how the average fuel oil consumption has come down by about 74,000 liters or megaliters, I'm not sure what the figure was, per month. But If I look at that, your 2020 monthly average consumption is still way higher than the average consumption in the 5 years prior. How is that a win, and why is it so much higher? Why did it jump so significantly in 2019-2020? Could I get some clarity on that, please? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also have quite an, I think as the previous members have alluded, that it was quite a lengthy presentation with quite a lot of layers as well. I think I have about 7 questions. The first one being that I think the basis under which even ESCOM is considering the use of clean coal technology, among other things, it is because of environmental impact and climate change related issues. So my question is that, because these are conversations that have been there for a very long time, especially those which produce a lot of CO2 into the climate, to sort of look into other technologies. Now, why is there so much that was not done before? And then the second one, I think it's on the issue of water scarcity and us not having enough water being one of the reasons why ESCOM is not able to do certain initiatives. And I recall that what happens in South Africa is that sometimes we put restrictions only for a particular time. Same applies to when we do load shedding. I remember there was a time where people would be told from 8 o'clock, please switch in your gizzards, do this, do that, do that. But we are not making those initiatives like lifetime adjustments for our citizens. It's something that's only there for a few months, and then after that we go back to normal. And I'm trying to find out, why aren't there initiatives that are actually encouraging society to sort of change their lifestyle in terms of how they use energy, in terms of how they use water, so that we are not facing this scarcity and we do not wait for crisis moments to actually ask people to adjust their lives. I think it's on the research that is there. I'm interested perhaps in the research program that is there, particularly on the race, the gender, and also what proportion of the people that are part of the research program are local, what proportion is youth, and what proportion is people with disabilities. And one of the reasons I'm asking this is because whenever we start initiatives, considering the history of South Africa and the fact that South Africa is still considered one of the most unequal societies, whenever we start initiatives, it would make sense that at the core of these initiatives, we consider these people who were and are still at disadvantaged. And I think the fourth question would then be, what initiatives are there to actually rope in the people that I've just mentioned above, particularly also women as well? I'm also interested in the gender, to make sure that they are participating not only at the level of implementation, but also at the level of research, because sometimes we take information mostly from academic and very elite structures. And then when we apply resolutions, they do not resonate with people on the ground because they were not necessary. And I think, it's on the underground quote that the commercial is not assessed and it needs to be completed. And I just wanted for that to be elaborated. What does that mean? And then further on in the slide, it says that it would take about or it would need about, Eskom would need about 18 years to develop the technology around that. So I'm trying to understand like the logic behind that. I understand some things need like very long time frames, but considering the fact that the need for energy is like a current crisis right now. So do we as a country really have 18 years to spare on anything that is still being researched? And I think the last one, I think that one of the first lies, and I think it's also common knowledge that the international environmental requirements, they say that the CO2 emissions must have been curbed by 2025 to like, so I'm trying to figure, and that is like 4 years from now. So I'm trying to figure out which technologies or which initiatives to make sure that they are actually at the level that 4 years. Thank you very much.
Okay, Honorable Madogwe, let me say this thing. Honorable Madogwe, Honorable Kula, Honorable Malinga, Honorable Langa, just for future references, maybe to some degree, try next time. If possible, you can just go closer to even an office of the municipality. Technology seems to be a very, your network is a serious, I'm sure Honorable Madogwe, in certain areas, they may not have had the comments or questions because you were blaring. So it's just an advice. Abantu baseMerafong, please try and find a place closer where whatever you say we can hear. I don't want a member who doesn't get a response simply because we didn't hear the part of the question or statement or comment they were making. I know you, for now, Honorable Malinga and Kola and Langa, you didn't have this problem, but I'm looking at problem people who usually have a network challenge. Let's try so that your participation in the committee is not hinged in any way. DM, I'm leaving it to you. Then the team will see how they respond. I take it that you are in charge of the delegation. So next, if you are not there, I would go to Prof. But you are there as the executive authority responsible.
No, not
I'm giving it to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think these are very apt, highly technical questions. That's the reason we have experts here. So I'll just get over to Prof. He will then indicate how they will then deal with the questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DM. I think the questions were quite specific to the presenters who made these presentations, and therefore, I would just request that I think Mr. Derater direct the appropriate questions. But these were very specific, very probing and very useful questions that I believe we should answer. And I agree with the chair that I struggled to hear, I think, the last speaker, Ms. Madogwe, although her questions were quite pertinent. But we may need to revisit her and really get clarity on the questions. But let me hand over to Andre. But this have been very useful questions from all the honorable members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prof. And also thank you very much to the honorable members for the very pertinent and probing questions. I shall try to answer some of the questions, and I will defer to the Eskom colleagues on the call where my own knowledge is inadequate to give a full answer. First of all, thank you very much to the Honourable Mahlale. We are not aware of the carbon capture project at the University of Pretoria. Thank you very much for that information. We will definitely follow that up and ensure that we ascertain and assess what that means. And if there's any potential for us to use that technology for Eskom's purposes and Eskom's requirements. In terms of your questions that revolve around whether or not we can minimize the capital outlay either by requesting private investors to come and build some of these emission mitigation plants for us and then charge us an OPEX fee, and whether or not technology is available, I can respond that on a net present value basis, the answer whether Eskom spends the money up front and then recovers that capital expenditure over time, either through a contribution from National Treasury or through an increase in the tariff, is essentially the same as requesting a private investor to make the upfront investment and then recovering the capital investment as well as the operating cost over time. Now, while it may be true that the private sector could be more efficient in operating this particular emission abatement plant, it also bears mentioning that a private investor will in all probability seek to be rewarded with a profit element on top of that capital investment. So in our assessment, whether you spend the capex up front or whether you defer it and recover it in an opex charge from a private investor over time, on a net present value basis, the sums work out to be pretty much the same. But of course, there is a cash flow benefit in the short term, which alleviates that burden. We are open to exploring both options, and at the end of the day, we will do what is in the best interest of the South African electricity consumer, also subject, of course, to regulatory input and the direction that we receive from our shareholder. The continuous fluidized bed solution, if it is a fully commercialized and proven concept, which indications are at this stage that it will be, is at this stage, according to our assessment, unlikely to have a significant impact on the overall cost of mitigating our emissions. So there might be some benefit, but not a major benefit in terms of introducing this technology. We have not included in the 300 billion that we've estimated, the cost of carbon abatement. So that clearly is something that we would then have to consider as well as we roll out our new technology. Your comment on issues around biomass being more polluting, The benefit that we see in torrefied biomass relates to the fact that we effectively have a circular carbon capture that we can implement if we use biomass. So in other words, as the biomass grows through a process of photosynthesis, it traps CO2 from the atmosphere. Obviously, that CO2 is then released back into the atmosphere, but provided that you can continue planting crops, that cycle can be sustained. It bears mentioning, however, that it is potentially water intensive to continue to cultivate these crops, and that there are potential additional carbon emissions from the production of fertilizers, agricultural machinery, and so forth, as well as the transport of the biomass from its place of production to the power station in question that need to be considered. So this is not a panacea by any means. It is one of a portfolio of potential carbon mitigation options that we are investigating. The Honourable Milam also asked how will Eskom fund this, and that indeed is the conundrum. Clean air or cleaner air will come at a cost, and that cost will have to be recovered either through an increase in the tariff and or an increase in the equity contributions that we receive from National Treasury. So the increase in the tariff that we anticipate will be implemented if we were to go this full-blown route to full compliance is 7 to 10%, and that will be implemented over a 10-year period. Now, this of course enhances the business case for accelerating the retirement of our older power stations, who are the, in some respects the heaviest polluters because they haven't been equipped with emission abatement technology, and where we are unable to recover over the remaining life of the power station the cost associated with the investment abatement technology. So there is a very good opportunity for us here to consider opportunities to repurpose and repower those power stations using low or no carbon emission technology, installing, for example, photovoltaic panels on rehabilitated land where we used to operate open cast mines, installing potentially natural gas turbines, as well as wind turbines. So these are all options that are currently under investigation. We are looking at them as part of our Just Energy Transition Program, bearing in mind that there are many people who are heavily invested, and not only financially, but also from the fact that they earn their salaries from the coal value chain in coal mining and in the use of coal. So we need to ensure that any solution, any migration to cleaner energy technologies will not cause socio-economic disruption and destroy scarce jobs in the process. And therefore, the opportunity for us to repurpose and repower is a very important component of our Just Energy Transition initiative that we would like to share with you. We are in constant discussions, Honourable Milam, with the World Bank on the implementation of FGD at Medupi. We are at this point still in compliance with the requirements of our loan agreement. So we are proceeding with that project. We have issued an invitation to the market to provide us with further information on flue gas desulfurization technologies and how we can abate the sulfur emissions at Medupi. We are also investigating coal beneficiation technology, which will remove or will seek to reduce the coal-bearing particles or the sulfur-bearing particles in the coal, and in so doing, reduce the ultimate sulfur that is emitted through the stack. And Honourable Chair, just as an aside, I may mention that this is an area that we believe holds great promise for emission controls, is by paying far closer attention to the quality of the coal that is burnt in our power stations, and by ensuring that the coal is properly blended and also homogenized, that we're able to reduce our impact on the environment. And that is corroborated by careful analysis that we have been doing over the emission profile of some of our coal-fired power stations over the past number of years. At Grootvlei and Camden, the fact that we continue to invest there, I would like to request our group executive who heads up generation, Philip Dukashe, to please respond to this question. Philip.
Thank you, Andre. Good afternoon, honorable members. So the question around Camden and Grootvlei, we're continuing to run the power stations because we need all the power. At this stage, we are not stable. We at times we get challenged to meet all the requirements in terms of power. So we need all the power that we can get, and those stations are able to assist. However, Chair, we are not really investing in those power stations. We do all we can in running and as reliable as possible, but we're not putting new money to invest or develop or to improve the power stations as such. But it's just to keep them going and make sure that we meet all the legislative requirements. I think as the group chief executive indicated, we are looking at just energy transition for those stations, and those projects are accelerating. So at this stage, we just need all the power, and that's why we're continuing to make use of them and spend whatever money we need in order to make sure that they are running reliably. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. Can you also deal with a question on increased fuel oil consumption, please?
Thank you, Andre. So increased fuel consumption, unfortunately, it's directly linked to poor performance within our generation fleet. So as we have more trips, we then have to light up these units more and more, and that results in increased fuel usage. And also when we have the units, when they are unreliable, we have to provide fuel support. And also when we have wet coal, sometimes the combustion, how we burn the coal in the stations, it becomes unstable, and we then have to put in fuel support. But I think the biggest contributor is the increased unreliability, which we are trying to deal with when we have to support or have to do more light ups. Thanks, Andre.
Thank you very much, Philip, for that response. We are now moving on to the questions raised by the Honorable Madokwe. So your question, Honorable Member, is absolutely pertinent, and it's at the foundation of the transition into new, cleaner and greener technologies. South Africa has a very large coal endowment, and as I said earlier, we have significant investment as a country in the coal value chain. We do recognize, however, that we have international obligations in terms of the Paris Agreement in particular, to which South Africa is a signatory, to reduce our carbon footprint in line with our international obligations. Accordingly, South Africa and Eskom in particular have to find a balance between capital investment, emissions, carbon emissions in particular, the availability of coal to feed our power stations, additional generation capacity that we require to feed our growing economy, and hopefully we can ignite more growth in the economy and Eskom would like to support that growth, obviously. And the opportunity to access new technologies, including renewable energy and natural gas, that have a far lower carbon footprint than coal combustion, and which enables us to make a transition as our coal-fired fleet, which is currently 39 years old, approaches retirement age. And that, I think, creates both an opportunity, but also something that needs to be managed very carefully. And hence, government has issued the Integrated Resource Plan in its 2019 iteration. And that makes explicit provision for the introduction of these new technologies, while at the same time preserving some space for coal, even as we put these older coal-fired power stations into retirement. So it is a very complex balancing act that we as a country and we as a utility have to maintain as we manage this transition. With regard to the question on the time that it takes to manage the very long timelines to develop new technology, you are right, 18 years is a very long time to commercialization, but we are confident that we will be able to reach of progress on these development projects. It bears mentioning, though, that we will, as I said, remain a sizable consumer of coal going forward, and we should therefore continue with our efforts to minimize the environmental impact of coal consumption, even though the time window for commercialization of these new technologies could be in the medium term and not in the short term as we would have liked. With regard to your question on transformation, particularly in the research and development space, I would like to hand over to our head of research, technology and development, Sumaya Naseeb, who is on standby to answer that particular question. Sumaya, please.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of RT&D, ISKM's business unit for research, testing and development, of our total staff complement, about 40% of the complement, just over about 109 of our staff members are technical females. Of this, 72% black, Asian and white is 12% each, and colored is 1%. About between 30 and 35% of these technical females are in the master's and PhD category. Obviously, we would we are encouraging further studies and skills development of all our staff. Further to that, we've also invested significantly over the past few years in what we call the tertiary education. It is a value proposition in terms of our investment, not only for the country, but also for us as ESCOM in terms of leveraging our R&D resources. So a portion of our funding on an annual basis does go into the NERSA determined R&D fund goes into the test program. Some of it also goes into what we call the ESCOM Engineering Power Plant or Power Plant Engineering Institute, where we also have quite a considerable number of Black, Asian, colored, both males and females that have achieved their master's degree level, as well as their PhDs. What is also important to note is that over the past 4 to 5 years, we've trained and skilled well over 200 engineers in training and graduates in training. Unfortunately, the bulk of which we've had to release, but we do believe that we are having a positive impact on the energy sector R&D for the country. What I would like to mention as well is that the RT&D section or unit is also embarking on a business model where we've looked at internal technical support services and looking at actually the establishment of Black youth-owned and Black woman-owned sustainable technical enterprises, which we hope would, some of our staff would have the opportunity for shareholding in. And that just builds supply development and localization chain that is sustainable, that is technically based, etc. I'll stop there if there are any questions on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sumaya, for that response. Honorable Chair, honorable members, we hope we have addressed the questions raised by members and submit to the chair, please.
Okay. When you say to the chair, I thought you were saying to your chairperson of the board or the DM. DM, yes, I'm sure you yes, Len Rapanga Sekaya. Kwani ndikuthwa indoduma uyinikile ni chai sign. Kufuneka nobe singumdaphu sisele yokugcina uyibuyisele kuyo ibe iyo eyichimayo yawo. So I thought when it comes back, izogcina ngawe.
No, no, Chair.
Usucima umdepho wakho.
Yes, yes. No, no, no. Understood, understood, Chair. I think that as best as we could, I think the questions have been responded to, but also the areas of follow-up will also take interest, particularly where we seem to have some best practice for the world nearby. So it's a matter that we will, in concert with the entity, follow up on that opportunity. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, DM. Honorable members, are there any follow-up, any take? I see again, Honorable Mailem, Honorable Mahlaule. Before I come, we take this exercise, DM and the Prof and the GCO. Simple because as a committee that is responsible for policy formulation, which has a direct impact to yourselves, we have to, from time to time, make measure of what is happening. So this exercise in the main, not necessarily, it won't be wrong anyway about accounting, but also is to see where we think we can assist, advise, in order to ensure that we deal with an accelerated process. So it is more complementary, but at the same time, where there are areas that we can critique, we will do so because that's our duty. But also our duty is to build, is to assist. So when we raise these issues, it's simple because we are looking at the test that is embedded to all of us, including those who are responsible for policy formulation. So I don't want, sometimes I always say I should have warned people, I don't want this thing that when people, they come to a committee of parliament, we always present something that is very good. And we end up not doing justice to something that we could have not just enlightened each other, but we could have also shared ideas and find solutions. But having said so, let me give Honorable Mailem follow up and Honorable Mahlaule.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, it's just the one question that I'm following up on, and that was my question about Camden and Grootvlei. And I think the question was misunderstood. I understand the need to keep the lights on and the electricity flowing. However, both of those plants are scheduled for decommissioning in the short term. And my question wasn't on investment in the plant or keeping the plant operational. My question was, the slide 23, indicates that both of those plants have in the last couple of years had investment in carbon emission control technology installed at those plants. And surely it would be better to invest that in plants that have got a longer life cycle or a longer lifespan still ahead of them, rather than in plants that you're going to be decommissioning in the very near future. So I'd really like some understanding of why we are putting carbon emission control or emission control technology into plants that we're about to decommission. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Thanks, Chairperson. I have two follow-up questions, but maybe I should start with, because as members of parliament, we say things that we say them under oath. So I got a sense that there is something that CEO Durater did not hear me properly on. I did not say the University of Pretoria, that's where the technology is housed. However, just for record purposes, it's in the Nestle plant in Hammanskraal in Pretoria. I just wanted to correct that so that I don't mislead the Committee of Parliament. Chair, the first question I want to follow up on is it emanates from the response by the CEO again on biomass. And I want to draw him to the attention of the US Environmental Protection Agency, which says that biomass, like he correctly says, leads to deforestation because naturally trees consume or absorb CO2. Now, that's not where we are not agreeing with the CEO. We agree because that's the point. That is understanding. The point comes where there is a power station somewhere in the world called Drax Power Station. It is in the UK. That came under heavy criticism for this particular issue. And when you read, you will be told that Europe has already U-turned in moving that direction on biomass. And I'm saying as a country that is developing, shouldn't we be paying attention to this scientific results that are coming to us and learn something and see a developed country or developed countries U-turning on biomass, but we are still going there? Shouldn't we be taking this science seriously and investigate whether can we go there or we should also U-turn before it's too late? The second point, Chair, is it was not asked by me, but was asked here, is that if Eskom remains in breach of its debt obligations, and I'm saying this with regards to the emissions schedule, can Eskom then in this meeting elaborate what expenses, to what extent is the breach going to cost Eskom, if there are penalties to be paid by Eskom? Can we be probably taken on board? To what extent will that affect the country or Eskom itself? Because the financial situation it finds itself may require us to be looking at saving more than incurring more penalties that otherwise would avoid. Thank you very much.
Okay, Nendo Tim, probably you can give so that we wrap up.
No, thank you very much. Can you get back to the group chief executive?
Thank you very much, honourable members. Just to respond quickly to the honourable Milam, I think your comment is spot on and well made. We need to look at the opportunity to recover the cost of investment with regard to environmental abatement, having regard to the remaining lifespan of a power station. This is a discipline that we are increasingly focusing on in Eskom in order to optimize our capital expenditure. We are requiring net present values to be calculated for each and every investment, obviously also linked to loss avoidance in the event that we have to shut down a particular power station or a unit for being non-compliant. So this is quite important for us to get right. I don't think we have optimized our capital expenditure in the past. I think we are paying far greater attention to this particular element over the past year or so. And we are now at a position where we have, at one particular power station, Tutuka, changed our approach to installing a fabric filter plant by focusing far more on operational parameters. And in so doing, we avoided capital expenditure of between 3 and 5 billion rand by being more focused on obtaining the right techno-economic evaluation. So there are opportunities to optimize. And I can give the Honourable Member the assurance that Eskom is very much focused on optimizing its capital expenditure across the portfolio and to avoid wasteful expenditure. Thank you very much for the reference to the Nestlé plant. We will certainly take a look at that plant and see what opportunities we have to glean from their experience. With regard to biomass, the Honourable Member is absolutely right. Biomass is only a niche application. It is not something that will be able to substantially mitigate our carbon footprint. Where there is biomass that we can torrefy and that we can use, it could be a supplementary fuel, but it will never play a meaningful role. There are some Scandinavian countries, for example, with very large and sustainable timber industries where biomass is used for power generation, but again, a very niche application dependent on local conditions. And we therefore fully agree with the Honourable Member that we are not pursuing this with a view to a massive commercial rollout. I would like to request the Eskom CFO, Caleb Kassim, to respond on the cost to Eskom and by implication to South Africa if there were to be a default under the World Bank loan in terms of FGD. But again, just to stress, we are collaborating very closely with the World Bank on this matter. We had a meeting again with the World Bank on Saturday on this issue, and we are aligned as to the progress that Eskom is making on this particular project. So I just want to emphasize that the risk of a default at this point in time is under control. Caleb, if you can maybe just give us more information on the consequences, please.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and members. Over and above what the GCE has said, I think the only other key issue is if in any event we do get to a default, and as highlighted, we are working very closely with the World Bank on this and supported by our shareholder ministry and National Treasury. It could lead to Eskom getting to a situation where what was granted to Eskom in terms of the overall loan, we would then need to repay and that then would become due. And if I recall, the total loan agreement with the World Bank is $3.75 billion. So, Honorable Members, I think that's the, if we ever get there, we would then have that cash flow requirement to meet as and when it becomes due in the event of some breach. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And finally, Honourable Chair, if we can just respond again on the Grootfontein-Camden matter, I would like to invite our Chief Operating Officer, Jan Uber, also to quickly make a few remarks on that topic, just to close that one out.
Good afternoon, Honourable Member, Members and GCE. Yeah, about Camden, first of all, around 5 years ago, a little bit more than 5 years ago, we had to replace the burners in the power station to continue with the operations. So we actually replaced it at with low NOx burners. And the last set was actually replaced last year. So this, at the time, was an investment decision to continue with the operational operations of Camden. Now, Grootvlei in 2016, to continue with the three remaining units at Grootvlei, we had to replace the fabric filter plant as well to continue the operation of the power station. So that's why the investment decision was made, I believe, about 4 or 5 years ago. But Honourable Chair, to confirm that these old power stations, we will not continue to make any new investment. So the investment, as the Group Executive Generation has commented earlier, will only be to continue the operation of the two existing power stations, for that matter, some of the other old ones, like Endrina as well, just for operational purposes up until the drop dead date updates as defined. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Are you done?
Yes,
Mr. Dereja.
Yes, Honourable Chair, okay. We submit back to you.
Okay, thank you. DM, your last words.
Thank you, Chair. I want to just express the appreciation of the particularly the items as the shareholder department. We take note of the policy implications of some of the issues that have been raised, yes. And I think, Chair, it's been worth the while. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, DM. Thank you, Prof. Thank you, the GCO and your team, Mr. Director. As I said, I think it was a very productive meeting that we have had, and at times it's also, you know, when you do policy, it's important sometimes to find the practical experience. Obviously, honorable members will deal with the issues, and I hope we'll be able to then agree on a way forward. But I usually say you first adopt the minutes. It's not a report, and when we deal with matters arising, we'll then have to say what then becomes the way forward in going. So it may not be our last meeting with ESCOM, especially on this issue. There are issues that have got implications in terms of the international protocols, but also in terms of the policy framework that we have agreed on. It's very critical also to say, as we move towards the issue of the budget proposals, including the annual performances, these are some of the issues that we need to factor them in. One of the things we've realized is that in government, every time you do something, you must factor in costs that are related to that particular initiative. So we will look at quite a broader with a broader eye on how do we handle the situation going forward. Before I close, I said to this person, I'm not laughing, but some of the things are very strange. Just on a lighter note, whilst we're busy in the I get a comment on the side that one of our staff, Mr. Ariko, was saying that he's chasing someone outside his house. They stole the tap. Now, I didn't know that. Now, if you've got a tap in your yard, it's no longer safe because they stole his tap. Now, he has to go and chased the person, we couldn't find, and we have to release him now to go and check where this person might have gone, including on the scrap here. So make it a point that your houses with the taps outside are safe. I never knew or anticipated that having a tap outside is a risk these days. But on that note, though, I hope you'll find your tap and be able to stop the water from running. I'm told it's a common experience. I hope it's a common experience around Cape Town. Otherwise, if it's spread, we're going to have a huge problem and a huge challenge. But on that note, thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you very much to ESCOM. Thank you very much to DM for public enterprises. We really appreciate your presence. We know you are not necessarily by protocol, but in this committee, but obviously by virtue of the fact that policy direction at times comes from this department on certain issues, we have to also find a way where we can have an interaction. But we really appreciate, thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Until tomorrow, honorable members, we meet again.